Good afternoon. If Senator Metzger will quiet down, we will get started. And I want to welcome you all to the House Interim Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. Thank you, colleagues, for being here. Thank you, Co-Vice Chair Boone, for coming in perfectly on time.
Right on the money.
And for all those millions listening at home, we have several agenda items, although I've been told not as many as the Senate side, a fact that I'm proud of. And we're going to get right to them. I do want to announce that my co-chair, Jules Bailey, is not here today. He is, as many of you know, a consultant to the independent channels Portlandia, and he is in New York consulting on new storylines. Most of the storylines for Portlandia come from his district. He's not here. He's not calling in. That's why I'm getting away with this stuff. But we do miss him. He's a good co-chair, and we're going to continue on without him this time. The first item on our agenda is the 10-year energy action plan. And I'm pleased to call Margie Hoffman up, because Margie has just recently taken this job and in 2 months has become an expert. And you'll see why in just a moment. So welcome, Margie.
Thank you. Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me here today. My name is Margie Hoffman. I am the Energy Policy Advisor for Governor John Kitzhaber, and want to thank you all for taking the time to allow me to come and present on the 10-year energy plan and where we are and where we're going today. So, Representative, at the end of last year, there was a task force that was put together that included a number of different stakeholders that work in energy and stakeholders that care about energy. And that citizen task force worked for about 6 months to put together recommendations in several different issue areas, including energy efficiency and demand management, utility scale generation and siting, resource mix, and governance. Those recommendations are summarized in the Oregon Energy Task Force report, which is the document that I just handed out to you. In this document, there are 198 recommendations that go through those different issue areas and talk about things that Oregon could be doing in order or could include in a 10-year energy plan. My first day on the job was April 2nd of 2012, and I have spent the last month and 3 weeks going through the task force report recommendations and looking at what are some of the practical solutions that we can implement over the next 10 years to provide predictable, stable and reliable energy to Oregonians. We're focusing on three issue areas: energy efficiency, energy infrastructure as a whole, and then the transportation component piece. How are people getting from where they are to where they need to be? What type of vehicle are they using to get there? And what type of fuel are they using to power that vehicle? And how are we going to pay for it? So that's the general, that's generally where we are right now. The draft energy plan will come out on June 1st of this year, so next Friday. I'll make sure that all of you get a copy of that draft plan. On June 1, we'll begin a 60-day public comment period for stakeholders and members of the public to send us comments. We're also going to be coming soon to a city near you, so I'll make sure that you also know when we'll be in your area if you want to join us for a public meeting. And then we will take an additional amount of time to distill the public comments and sort through those, incorporate those into the plan, and finalize the plan later this year. So, more soon. But I just wanted to come and say hi.
Glad you did. And I want to commend you on your communications skills so far, because I appreciate you coming to my office. I know you've come to many other members' offices and others in the building. And I want to also be sure you know, I think you do, that I don't shoot the messenger. And I do note that you, when you joined and how quickly you've had to get up to speed and how much more work there is to be done. However, I want to remind everyone, at least from this co-chair's perspective, how concerned I was during the citizen group process about the communication. So I take your new communication as an encouragement, because whether it was just ill-timed or for some other reason, I didn't feel like we, meaning legislative members particularly interested in energy issues, were particularly well-informed. And the bad timing part was that this report that you referred to, and I know we're going to move on from that and build on it, I think maybe came out the day after or shortly after Sine Die for the shorter session. So noting that, but looking forward and being positive, I'm hopeful that we do have the kind of communication that you and public hearings that you've alluded to. Just to be sure I heard you right, I think I did. We're interested in the task force report, but it is not the content of the report, the draft report that we see on June, that we will see on June 1, correct?
Correct.
With those few comments from me, I am open to any comments or questions from our panel. Are you taking a drink or are you asking to be called on?
Both.
Okay. Well, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for dropping by my office this morning and sharing some of these really interesting concepts. I did mention, and I'm highly interested in making sure that some of the wide open spaces in the greater part of the state, and might I add the cleaner and more open part of the state, be utilized more efficiently under this plan, because it seems to me that solar in particular has a huge future in this state, and yet for obvious reasons we don't seem to be taking advantage of that. So I'm very hopeful that this plan will somehow design a path through some of the more difficult and challenging regulations we've had imposed upon us. So having said that, tell us if you think that's a possibility. Do you think this plan might provide us a way toward 1,000-acre solar farms or even larger ones in the eastern part of the state, so Oregon can become a leader in this area as opposed to a wannabe?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz, thank you very much for the question. I really appreciate it. The siting portion of the task force recommendations get at the heart of your question, both in looking at the existing framework that we have in regulatory framework that we have for siting projects, and also looking at the future and balancing our need to harvest clean renewable power such as solar, biomass, geothermal, wind, and other sources, and also how we create certainty and predictability on the side of protecting the other natural resources that we have in our state. I can't tell you what will come out of the end of the sausage-making process, but I can tell you that we are very interested in looking at how we can, at what changes we can make to the existing siting infrastructure that we have, or siting process that we have, I should say, and looking at how we can create more predictability and certainty for developers and more predictability and certainty for agencies who are charged with protecting species, water, air, land, et cetera, et cetera.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you for that answer, and I appreciate that optimistic approach. I think that the challenge for me, as I'm going to get in my car after this meeting is over, I'm going to drive the 7.5 hours back to Ontario. 5.5 of those hours will be spent driving across the space between Bend and Ontario. 5.5 hours at somewhere around 60 miles an hour. And I'm going to be looking at part of the, after I get halfway across that space, on the other side of Bend, halfway across it, I'll reach my district. The western boundary of that district, and I'll enter into 19 million acres of space that I represent. 19 million acres, very few of which have any water, very many of which are flat as they could possibly be, all of which have more sun than the Willamette Valley gets in about 5 years, in 1 year. So my thought is, we have lots of energy and it's really, really clean. Yet for some reason, something's standing between us and the utilization of that incredible resource. And I'm hoping that this plan gets us closer to the utilization of that wasted asset. So I think what I just heard you say is that, yes, it will. Is that what I heard?
Again, I can... Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz, that is one of the things that we will be focused on. Again, I can't guarantee the outcome of that conversation, but we need to align the state's energy goals with the state's land use goals, and that's incredibly important. I think the other piece to that that we want to focus on is it's not always just about siting. It's about access to transmission. It's about financing and how we can finance these projects as well. So we want to look at all of those component pieces and how they are or are not working together, and what is the role of the state in helping to facilitate the transition to getting new renewable energy projects in the ground.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
A couple of things. First of all, for Representative Vance, if he would get State Representative plates on his car like Representative Krieger has, and he could drive 75 miles an hour, so I'm not particularly sympathetic to him. But extending on the energy options here, one of the problems, and I know this is premature to what you're doing, but to be cognizant of it, we have opportunities right now on the ground to develop biofuels that are just absolutely being curtailed by state regulation. I get a little irritated when I read about the lofty goals for the future and how we're going to become more energy independent, we're going to free ourselves from fossil fuels, and then I open up the book and, whoa, here's a whole list of regulations that keep us from doing that, and they're state regulations. Somewhere, we got to look at not the future, but where we are right now that's keeping things from happening, and that reflects on Representative Benz's question. I mean, I've been in his district, and I realize that property is a premium, but there are at least two places that I could identify 10,000 acres that we could put solar that wouldn't even be within view of a road, you know, and yet we keep dithering around about a 250-acre site or maybe only a 100-acre site or how about a 25-acre site. How about we just say all of his district is open for solar, period, and get ourselves moving on this stuff. But we the state, and unfortunately we're part of that, are the biggest anchor and deterrent to doing anything because we prohibit it. But yet we go with these lofty goals of how we're going to do it if we ever figure out a way to stop prohibiting it. It's illogical. And I would hope that as we move through this process, we do a real thorough examination of what we have on the books right now that's just idiotic.
Chair Gilliam, Representative Thompson, I just want to say that I really appreciate your comments. That's a lot of what we're talking about is creating alignment between the energy goals, where we want to get to in the next 10 years, and the kind of regulatory environment that will help support doing that. There are a mix of, in the task force report, the task force actually did an incredible job doing an assessment of existing programs in addition to a forward look and making suggestions about where we can go over the next 10 years. And I think the result of, if you look at the siting piece of the task force report, there are a lot of very strong recommendations put forward for opportunities that we have to amend our current regulatory structure to help us better align those goals, and also what we can do in the future to better align those goals. So I appreciate your comment.
I would hope we could do that.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Margie, thank you for being here today. And I know you referenced in part the importance of our energy transmission capacity in our state. And I was wondering if you might be able to give us some kind of insight as to how the state might go about helping to incent the development of additional transmission capacity, because it's not only the potential for solar development in Representative Benz's district, but it's also ocean energy development and a host of other energies, geothermal and whatnot, where we simply do not have transmission where the energy development potential exists.
Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, thank you for that question as well. a big focus of the governor has been integrating and aligning a lot of the state programs that we have. Transmission certainly falls into that, and looking at how we can transmission linear projects don't just deal with state lands and state jurisdiction, but they also deal oftentimes with private land and federal land, forest, Bureau of Land Management land, and that's not even considering when we move out into the oceans, how far you go out into the ocean. There is a regulatory streamlining process conversation that has started within the governor's office, and I would love to, I actually missed my 1 o'clock conference call today with Andrea Fogue, who is one of the people leading that conversation, so I'd love the opportunity to circle back with you on that, but we are actively having those conversations about how recognize the need for linear projects in the state of Oregon, and recognize the need to get those done in a timely manner while balancing the natural resources that we also need to protect in the state.
I would look forward to that opportunity to have that discussion.
Me too.
Thank you very much.
Senator Krieger.
You heard Representative Benz talk about his 19 million acres. Probably 15 million of that doesn't have any transmission capacity. So the idea of clustering those sites on adjacent landowners, and if someone, one landowner doesn't want to do it, allowing the adjacent landowner to have his capacity needs to be looked at. We talked about that last interim, that you know, you could have four adjacent landowners each having, you know, inside of one another, legally have, let's say, 200 acres, but you couldn't let one of them have 800. So there's a lot of things like what you've heard today, frustration about regulatory schemes or mechanisms that really don't make sense.
Thank you, Representative. If there are no other comments for Margie, I would say this, Margie, well, a little sidebar for the committee, given the fact that Representative Benz brought this up. With Co-Chair Bailey's agreement, we're going to be forming a solar siting work group. And if you're interested, both for my colleagues and those interested parties in the room, if you're interested in that, I hope you'll let Beth Petrino, our committee administrator here to my right, know that. And my point is this, that I understand your reticence to, at this stage, guarantee anything, so I don't fault you one bit. But I can guarantee you this, that we, as a committee and as co-chairs, are committed, and we'd be happy to work with you and with the next group that is working on this, or to just keep moving on ahead as a committee. This has been a troublesome issue, and I'm very disappointed that we were, as a legislative body, promised a solution to this, a way to go forward. There are so many wins in this, and Representative Benz and others are far more articulate, but there are so many wins in this particular issue, and it could be a great way to galvanize those who want to work together in the 10-year plan. And I would say there's no better way to start or place to start than getting this, as I call it, solar on the rocks going, and get those jobs that are just dying to be reaped out there in his district, get them going. We're very, very close, and yet somebody keeps putting another hurdle up, even after work groups have promised. You don't need legislation. We can do this. And so here we are, and I'm not laying all this at the feet of this governor, because I think we've been going through this through two administrations. But we need to move forward on this. And if this group wants to, great. If you don't, it's my intention. I guarantee you I'm going to try. So anyway, that's the word on the solar siting work. We call it task or work group. Work group. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And don't forget the jobs that could be realized, not in my district, but I'm sure I have a couple of constituents who work for Solar World, that we could ramp up that whole operation.
That's a very good point. So with that, we'll let you off the
hot seat. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for joining us.
I look forward to working with all of you.
We're going to move on now to a familiar topic and an update, a report on the paint care response to that whole paint care issue. And I'd like to invite Allison Keene and Marjana Zarparvar, and I'll bet you I just butchered it, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you did a really good job.
I was practicing up here before you got up here. If you'll identify correctly for the
record,
we'd be happy to, and you can self-select whoever would like to go first.
Sure, I'm going to go first. I'm Allison Keene, chair and committee members. Thank you so much for having us here today. I'm here representing the American Coatings Association. We're a trade organization in D.C. that represents paint coating manufacturers. We're also the organization that put together Paint Care, the nonprofit sidearm of the American Coatings Association that's putting the program in place in Oregon. One of the reasons we did that is because we wanted to test a pilot program in the United States and then move it to other interested states. So I'm here today with Marjana Zarparvar, so you really did do a great job on that. She is the executive director for Paint Care, and Rick Vopel, who is actually our program coordinator here in Oregon. I'm going to let Marjana start out with some of the successes we believe the program has brought to the state, and then I'll follow up with our response to DEQ's report.
Great.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Gilliam and committee members, and thank you for the introduction, Allison. Allison already described what Paint Care's role is in the Oregon Paint Stewardship Program. And as you may be aware, following your leadership here in Oregon and passing the... Yes?
I need you to say your name for the record.
Marjana Zarparvar.
There's two issues. Just move...
Spell it.
Move that microphone back just a hair.
Back.
They're very sensitive, away from you. And then self-identify, I'm sorry.
Marjana Zarparvar.
Great.
Great. Thank you. I was just saying that thanks to your leadership here in passing the First in the Nation paint stewardship legislation, two other states, California and Connecticut, have followed your lead. So Paint Care is actually active in three states right now and will continue to grow into other states that follow your lead again and pass similar legislation in the future. However, today, it's my pleasure and to have the opportunity to share with you the successes of the Oregon program, the success that Paint Care, DEQ, and the rest of our partners have achieved so far, again, in this first-of-its-kind industry-led stewardship program. So there's four areas in particular that I'd like to highlight, and these are the four areas that I think would be of interest to you as well. Those are the cost of the stewardship program and the allocation of those funds within Oregon, the changes in collection infrastructure and the convenience level that's provided for residents and businesses in Oregon, the volume and the disposition of the paint that we've collected through the program, and finally, the efforts that we've made to educate and conduct outreach about the program to consumers in Oregon. So beginning with program costs, as you may be aware, the program in its first full year cost $3.3 million. I'm not sure if you know that more than 80% of that money went back into the Oregon community and to the service providers that we work with. Those are hazardous waste management companies, PR firm that we work with, and local governments as well. Portland Metro actually, in fact, has told us that the program has saved them $1 million in operational cost. So that's a third of the funds going straight into a local government program here in Oregon. Of course, savings to local government is key. It was certainly one of the primary drivers for the reason for why this program exists, why the legislation was passed. And as a side note, I'd just like to share that I'm particularly sympathetic to this program because before joining Paint Care in August of last year, I worked in local government for 13 years. I ran San Francisco's household hazardous waste programs. So I know what it's like to run a hazardous waste program under a very constrained budget and to do the best you can to provide some kind of service to your constituents because everybody has paint and needs a solution for what to do with it. Also, before leaving the subject of the funding of the program or the cost of the program, I should note that as required by the statute, we did at the end of year one have a third-party independent audit of the program, which found the program to be fiscally sound and in compliance with all the required accounting principles. And you may have seen a copy of that audit. If you haven't, we're happy to share that with you. Moving on to the second issue, which relates directly to the burden on local governments of managing these programs, I'd like to highlight how the paint collection opportunities have changed since the implementation of the Oregon legislation. Prior to the Paint Care program, there were approximately 15 local government programs. Since then, we've grown collection opportunities to 99 permanent collection sites. Of those 90 collection sites, 80 are retail, 70 are actual paint retailers, and 10 are some sort of a reuse store like a Habitat for Humanity. But you can see there's a big shift from local government only programs, to the majority of them being retailers stepping up and as part of the shared responsibility model participating by serving as a collection site. But I think even more significant than the increase in the number of sites is the distribution of these locations and the increased flexibility that they offer to consumers. As you probably know, household hazardous waste programs tend to have very limited days and hours, sometimes a couple days a week if you're lucky, sometimes maybe just once a month. In contrast, household hazardous waste programs also tend to be inconveniently located. They're not usually in a city center because, of course, mostly you don't usually want it in your backyard. In contrast, retail stores tend to be centrally located in a population area, are open 6 or 7 days a week. So I think that it's not just the number of collection sites that's increased, but the convenience both in terms of the hours of availability and how much more convenient they are to get to. The third item I'd like to highlight is the volume that we've collected, the amount of paint that's been collected in the program. In year one of the program, we collected more than 450,000 gallons of paint. And we do expect that number to go up slightly every year as more consumers become aware of the program and as we clean out those garages of paint that's been collected for many years. And so far, 9 months into the second year of the program, we can see that those numbers have slightly increased. We expect, again, to see that for a couple more years. So far in year two, in the 9 months that we've been running in year two, we've collected, or year one and year two combined, we're up to about 800,000 gallons of paint. So I know that's a hard number to try and imagine. I have a hard time visualizing what that means. So I like to use a reference, and I usually think of 55-gallon drums, so that the drums that you usually see hazardous waste liquids transported in. So if you can visualize those, they're about this tall, this wide. It's about 14,000 of those drums worth of paint, so certainly could fill this room many, many times over. So a large volume, we've done a great job in bringing that paint in. All of that paint has been recycled or gone to some form of beneficial reuse, whether it's paint back into paint through Portland Metro's program or used as a fuel substitute, the paint is going to some kind of secondary use. And we do think that as more of these paint programs come on board in additional states, we'll see additional innovative opportunities and ways in which this paint can be managed, possibly increase the market for opportunities, maybe even here in Oregon. And the final issue that I wanted to highlight was education and outreach and the efforts that we've made around that issue, the level of consumer awareness of the program. So through a pre- and post-survey of the Oregon population, we learned that newspaper and radio are the most effective ways to reach the Oregon community for this type of a program, at least. So as a result, we've implemented a large-scale outreach campaign using both of these two media. Some of our ads focus on general awareness. You know, there's a fee associated with this program. Why are you paying it? What do you get in return for it? Some are more specific, and we'll list the actual sites that are in the neighborhood where that paper is being read. Another very important component of our outreach campaign is point-of-sale information. So you go into a retail store where you're buying the paint. You'd like to learn right there, what is this program about? So to assist retailers in communicating the benefits of the program and the purpose of the program, we've developed a range of items, rack cards, posters, other things, and made them available to all paint retailers in Oregon. Unfortunately, our survey showed that there wasn't a lot of awareness or use of those program materials. But we still think that's an important component, so we're holding a retailer stakeholder meeting next month to get feedback on what can we do to modify those materials, to improve them, to make them both more catchy for the public, and to have retailers use them more. We want to get the direct feedback. So as you can see, we're working hard to figure out what's working and what's not, paying careful attention, and doing what we can to improve where there's elements that we can improve on. So there's a lot more information, obviously, that I could share with the program, but I'll just stop here and pass it on to Allison. I hope I've provided enough information to convey to you the accomplishments and innovation that have been driven as a result of you leading the nation by passing this first legislation. So thank you for your leadership, and thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions after Allison.
Great.
Hold on just a minute. Would you like a question?
Just a quick,
please.
Yeah. I would like to make a suggestion, and it might help save you some money, too, but contractors buy a lot of product, and if you could maybe make up a piece that could be a stuffer in a bill, they get monthly bills sent, and you could do it, you know, every month or every quarter or something like that, because I know a lot of them, they don't have time to look up stuff and mm-hmm. send somebody they have to pay to drive to a mm-hmm. place where they can return this. Mm-hmm. But if they know about it, they can plan for it.
Some kind of a bill insert that goes specifically to contractors?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an important audience.
Thank you for that feedback.
citizens do.
Yeah, so. Very good. Thanks.
Okay. So as Marjane reported, we obviously think this program is very successful. We obviously know that there's always room for improvement, but I'd like to just address the recommendations from the DEQ report in light of what we see this program and what it means to the paint industry with regard to the underlying legislation. There are some areas, and you have my full point-by-point outline, I believe, has already been presented to you, but there are some areas that we do agree with the DEQ, and one would be because we do believe it's successful, and we're now going to into California to operate this year, and we're going to be in Connecticut next year, and we keep having this legislation pass little by little through the states that are interested. We welcome having this become permanent. The pilot was supposed to be put in place so that an industry could test it in the United States. It has been going on in Canada for many, many years. But this was our opportunity for a United States-run industry-led program. We believe it has been successful enough so that we would like to see it be made permanent. The legislation that we've passed in other states after Oregon is all permanent legislation. Oregon is the only pilot. We also agree that there's improvements to be made, certainly with clarification and strengthening education and outreach. As Marjane says, we produce all of the point-of-sale materials for all paint retail stores in the state, but unfortunately we can't mandate that they use them. So we'd like to work a little bit more closely with DEQ on solving that problem, and a little bit more closely, as Marjane said, with the retailers themselves in finding a solution where they will actually use the product we give them and engage the consumer right at the point of sale. And then finally, we don't disagree that aerosol should be added to this program at some point, and the legislation actually affords us that opportunity. I think it's just a matter of time. It's a different product. They're different manufacturers, and it has to be managed in a much, much more different way than the program products that we're managing today. Unfortunately, we disagree with the majority of the rest of DEQ's recommendations. And again, let me just go back to the purpose of the program and what we believe is the policy underlying it. We think most of the other recommendations in the DEQ report would really only add cost and burden to the program without some commensurate environmental benefit. We put this program in place and we supported the legislation because we fundamentally believe that an extended producer responsibility or product stewardship program, one where industry takes ownership and runs and manages programs for the end of life of their own products, is the way to go. It's a way to reduce government costs, reduce the burden on local governments, and really bring everybody in the chain of custody that produces and sells paint into the solution for the end of life management. Unfortunately, I think the DEQ recommendations really enhance the government's role, which in this case we think it really should be industry run and led. And as a nonprofit company, my job and Marjane's job on behalf of our manufacturers and really on behalf of the residents of Oregon is to keep the program as cost-effective as possible. Oregon residents are paying for the program through the new purchase of paint that's embedded in the retail purchase price of the product. So anything that just adds cost but doesn't add benefits is not good for the Oregon consumer, and certainly not good for my manufacturers who don't collect any of this money. They don't want to add cost to their product unless they can the consumer can derive a benefit from it. So specifically, some of the recommendations mandating what costs we have to pay service providers or reimburse service providers, particularly collection locations. We fundamentally believe that we need to be able to run this and run it as a business. So we need to have freedom to contract in the marketplace and get the lowest price costs we can. And consideration for any of our service providers is provided in each individual contract. We certainly would not want to see the government come in and start mandating our contract terms. Also, since it's an EPR program, and we do believe, again, that it should reduce the size of government, not enlarge it, a lot of the recommendations actually give them more oversight and more management of the program, including additional reporting requirements and the ability to approve or disapprove those reports based on what we believe are some arbitrary or really non-existent criteria. So again, adding more cost and burden to the program, but not really giving any rationale for how it would improve the efficiency or the environmental benefits of the program. And lastly, to suggest, I think, that less transparency in what we're doing with regard to the financing, with regard to the funding of the program being through the purchase price of new paint, is fundamentally, we believe, a bad public policy. As a matter of fact, we want to get out to the consumer, and we want to, like I said, we agree with DEQ that we should enhance the education and outreach, and this is really part of it. This is what you're paying, this is where the money's going, and this is why the program's in place. So that's fundamentally our approach, our consumer approach, and we wouldn't want to see that changed. So I think more importantly than, again, since you have my my letter in your hands, more importantly than going through any more of the points, we'd really like to answer some specific questions. And going forward, make sure that the program is permanent, but works both for DEQ and local government partners, but also for the manufacturers who supported the underlying legislation.
Let me ask you on that last point, because I think I might have misunderstood it. The DEQ recommendation on transparency, you object to because it you think it would create less transparency? You're already doing it? I didn't get that part.
Yes, Chair. We believe that the point 8 where they said DEQ should look to potentially mandate that the funding for the program, replacing the funding for the program with a mechanism that internalizes the cost of the program so you wouldn't be transparent to the consumer. We are now very transparent to the consumer, and we don't want to lose that.
So just to follow up, you think it's unnecessary? The recommendation is unnecessary given the way you're already operating?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions? Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and very much appreciate this report. So how much more paint has been collected now that we have this program in place than was the case before it was in place?
I'm sorry, I'm not good with the protocol, but Chair Gilliam and Representative Benz, I'm making sure I get everybody's name right. It's incredibly difficult to account for what was collected prior to the program versus today just because of a lot of different factors and the way different household hazardous waste governments collected the product and measured, frankly, the product. And also because our program products are very specific to architectural paint, and in the case of like oil-based paint, they might have been commingled with other paint-related material. Having said that, we did the best analysis that we possibly could, and we came up with a 3% increase over, I believe, 2008 numbers that Oregon DEQ was able to supply.
Right. I think I had understood it to be almost exactly the same, and that what we'd basically done is increase the cost to the consumer with no additional paint being brought back in, or on your numbers, 3% more. So what we've done is we've increased the cost to the consumer by, what is it, a can, 50 cents?
It's 35 cents on small, 75 cents on gallon, and it's $1.60 on 5-gallon containers.
Okay, so what we've done, and that roughly is how many millions of dollars?
We raised $4 million for the program in the first year.
Right, so the one might call it, and by the way, I voted for this bill. I think it's a good idea if it's appropriately handled. The difficulty I've had with the program goes straight to Chair Gilliam's question, which was transparency and whether or not we were creating an opportunity for a, quote, not-for-profit, end quote, organization to make money on the Oregon consumer for no additional benefit to the Oregon consumer. So transparency to me is absolutely essential if this program is going to survive. The only reason we have or you have the opportunity to do what you're doing is because we passed a law allowing it. And so to me, it's absolutely essential that your organization be in position to say how much good you're doing or not. And so I view that which the DEQ has asked for as essential if we as a group are going to do our job and see if this additional tax is doing the people of Oregon any good. And so the piece of that is of greatest interest to me is how you're going to get the word out that this money that's being paid is going to actually do something more than a 3% increase in the amount of cans that already were coming back. So what is it that you're going to do to drive that number up? I heard you say earlier that it was going to go to eight, you know, twice basically what we've had apparently. And what's going to actually cause that to happen? I have that question. And Mr. Chair, if you'll forgive me, I have one more question to follow this up. What are you going to do, if I may, to double the volume of paint that's being returned?
Well, we're not going to work to double the amount of paint being returned. What we want to do is collect the paint that's out there that can be returned. And I would suggest that the fee that the consumer is now paying for this program is not over and above what they were paying before. It's actually replacing what they were paying before, and it's reducing the cost to the local governments who were doing it prior to that. In addition, it is giving...
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I don't follow that point. Could you go back and say that again?
Sure. So
how was the consumer already paying the additional money that they're now paying?
So what the consumer is paying for under the Pain Care program today actually reduces the cost and burden on the local governments that they were paying in their taxes before. So in essence, we're saving local governments like Oregon, Portland Metro, over $1 million in the first year of the program. That's a direct cost savings to them and their taxpayers funding the program. We now are paying for the management of paint transportation, paint recycling, instead of the local governments that paid for it prior to the program. But in addition, I do believe there's a couple other fundamental points here. Number one, we've addressed the convenience. So before, when Portland Metro and a couple other counties had very robust programs, but the rest of the state had nothing. So we've spread out where that paint is coming from and how easily a consumer can get it back into the program. But also, we make paint to go on the wall. So we sort of have a diametrically opposed policy here. And one way, we're going out to the consumer and we're saying, you know, use it all up. And if we don't have a waste management issue where that's concerned, then we don't have to have a program and there would not be any additional cost, whether to the consumer or to the taxpayer. At the same time, we're saying, but we do know that there is some leftover paint. So if there is that leftover paint, bring it in. But part of our mantra is actually to reduce what's coming back into the program through reuse and through using it all up, buying the right amount, et cetera, et cetera. The other part is to bring back what's already in everybody's basements and garages. And the program pays not just for new paint coming back, but for everything everybody's stockpiled for various amounts of years.
Mr. Chair, please. I appreciate the hope that the program works better. And it's going to have to work better, or I'm going to support not having the program. Because when I go out to my little Home Depot and my little True Value and my little, I think we have a Sherwin-Williams out there, just was built, and these other places, I find little evidence of this program. And what I do hear from folks is that they are not those that are asked to recover this stuff, appropriately being reimbursed for the recovery costs. Now, that's been a while back, and that may have been repaired or fixed. The piece of this program that is upsetting to me, that or your, I just have had the most shortest amount of time possible to review your report, but the umbrage you're taking toward the DEQ is of concern to me, because I view the DEQ as an appropriate oversight agency for what you're about. And so I would hope that, and I must say, the discussion in the report in this section centering on paint care paying certain costs to some service providers bordered on the intentional interference with the contract. Okay, I have little patience for this. I have no patience for this. The truth of it is we rely on the DEQ to make sure that organizations that are created by virtue of our action operate correctly. And that's so to see that the questions they're asking are they're being threatened with a suit for intentional interference with the contract. That does not vote. I don't like that. I'm just one of a group. But to me, this is a good program. I want to see it succeed, but I want to be able to see what the cost is to the consumer. And I've had repeated conversations with the DEQ on this issue. I have a feeling that's why some of the things are in their report. So my hope is that you will work with the DEQ and be able, they can come back to us and say, hey, this program is doing more than a 3% increase over what the status quo was. So that's what I'm thinking. And I would probably be more detailed, more focused on my questions had I had more time to review this report.
Yeah, no problem. And we are available at any time to answer any questions. We believe that we are as transparent as possible. We have an independent audit every year. We have an annual report that's incredibly important to us and is incredibly important to our manufacturers. And I wasn't threatening DEQ with the lawsuit. What I'm saying is this is an industry-run EPR program. The underlying legislation that was our legislation that we supported is working as intended, and we don't want to change it such that it's now a DEQ-run program. that the manufacturers are simply just paying for. And in order to do that, we need to be able to contract in the marketplace for all of the services based on individual negotiations and not based on a set government down rate. And I know that's how it used to be run, like advanced disposal fees, things like that, new paradigm shift. And that's what we just want to make sure that that fundamental principle of the legislation that we supported remains.
Thank you again for your indulgence. I think you just said the manufacturers are paying for it. They are not. The consumer is paying for it. And when I get calls from people in Baker City saying, why am I paying this additional money for this can of paint? I want to be able to say to them, there's a really good reason you're paying that, Mr. Constituent. And so the only way I can make sure that they are not paying too much for an industry, you know, generated, but I don't think that's the case, I'm going to call it legislative generated additional cost, is that DEQ can come in and say they've looked at what you're doing and it's a good thing. And I had serious questions about whether it was a good thing because I couldn't tell how much cost was actually being created as compared and how much profit was being generated in the so-called nonprofit. I couldn't see it. I think we need to see it. And there's been some reluctance, as I understand it, to share exactly how much money there is.
Mr. Chair.
Please. I'm sure the DEQ can address that reluctance more clearly because I've asked repeatedly for that information and we can't seem to get our hands on it.
I would love to get that information directly to you. We have it. It's available. I can even set up a meeting with our CFO and the independent auditors. We have it. It's available. Perhaps there's some communication issues between ourselves and DEQ. But again, PaintCare is our program, so please feel free. We totally agree DEQ's role should be oversight and enforcement. But we're running the program, and we can answer any question that you have very, very quickly. And I want everybody to know that they can contact us directly for that information.
I will do so. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. On to your point about the offset in taxpayer dollars, particularly in the metro area, Portland metro area, and I'm not expecting you to speak for the city of Portland, but have you had an opportunity, is that where you get your figure, so to speak, have you, in collaboration with them, come up with that kind of, I know it would be very difficult to pinpoint the actual amount, but in the ranges that you mentioned, is that something you have estimated in concert with the city?
That's actually what we pay Portland Metro for their services.
I see.
From collection through recycling the paint.
So you can't.
What used to be borne by Portland Metro's budget is now borne by PaintCare with respect to the architectural paint, not the rest of the HHW that they manage.
Okay.
So that's actual contracting prices that we pay to Portland Metro.
That's a good clarification. Thank you. Colleagues, other questions?
Well, we're glad you're here. We've had a little bit of a communication problem having DEQ first and then a long gap, so we're glad you're here and we hope we can improve that. And thank you for being here. We're going to move on to the next subject.
Absolutely. Thank
okay.
you so much for having
yeah.
us.
Colleagues, I don't know about you, but when I get contacted about our committee from people that I don't know very well, I can always tell their persuasion if they ask me if I'm the co-chair of the Environment Committee or if I'm the co-chair of the Energy Committee. And to that point, we're going to start talking about, some of you may prefer Oregon Clean Fuels Program, and some of you may refer to it as the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. Either way, that's our next subject. And we're going to have Palmer Mason come up. And Palmer, is it okay if Paul Logan comes with you? Can we do that at the same time? And you're both welcome, and let's get this conversation started.
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Palmer Mason, and I'm the Government Relations Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. Also here with me today is Paul Logan with the Department of Justice. Why don't you enter?
Yes, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, Paul Logan with the Department of Justice, for the record.
Thank you. And we've been asked to be here today to provide an update on the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, which is now known as the Clean Fuels Program. We've also provided the committee staff with some handouts, a copy of my testimony, and then another packet that has the fact sheet on the program, the governor's letter directing DEQ to go forward, and a timeline.
And we're going to get that packet in a moment, probably.
Okay.
I think we don't have that part. We have your testimony, but go right ahead.
Okay. Okay. So the Oregon Clean Fuels Program was authorized by the 2009 legislature in House Bill 2186. The goal of the program is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, which is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. The Clean Fuels Program would meet this goal by creating demand for lower carbon fuels like biofuels, electricity, and natural gas. Implementation of this program would support Oregon's climate change goals and many of the objectives of Governor Kitzhaber's proposed Oregon 10-year energy action plan, including reducing our dependence on foreign oil, developing homegrown renewable energy sources, and boosting Oregon and the nation's economy through investment and innovation. Since the adoption of House Bill 2186, DEQ has been evaluating the Clean Fuels Program, including a year-long advisory committee process and another year of stakeholder outreach. Last month, Governor Kitzhaber directed DEQ to take the next step by developing rules to implement the program in two phases. The first phase would allow DEQ and fuel suppliers to test the data management, technical tools, and procedures that would be needed to fully implement the program. During this phase, DEQ would also conduct a number of studies to determine if the second phase is warranted. The second phase, which only happens if separately approved by both the Environmental Quality Commission and the legislature, would require fuel suppliers to begin increasing the use of lower carbon fuels. To trigger phase two, the EQC would have to conduct a second rulemaking with its own fiscal and economic analysis and public comment period. The legislature's approval is also required because House Bill 2186 will sunset as of December 31st, 2015. Before I describe our path forward, I'd like to review the objectives and key elements of the Oregon Clean Fuels Program. There are three main ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. One, reduce the number of miles traveled. Two, reduce vehicle emissions from improved technology and other efficiencies. And three, reduce the greenhouse gas emissions per unit of fuel through programs like the Clean Fuels Program and other incentives that encourage the use of lower carbon fuels. Oregon needs to pursue all of these approaches to reach our greenhouse gas reduction goals. If phase two is implemented, the Clean Fuels Program would reduce greenhouse gas emissions per unit of transportation fuel by 10% over 10 years. Unlike the renewable fuels standard, it would not mandate any specific blend of biofuels to be added to gasoline and diesel. Instead, suppliers would decide how to meet the standard, whether by blending lower carbon fuels like ethanol and biodiesel into gasoline or diesel, or by working with other companies to substitute lower carbon fuels such as electricity, natural gas, and hydrogen for a small portion of the gasoline and diesel currently used in Oregon. Each type of fuel would be compared on an equal basis, considering emissions to the entire life cycle from production, refining, storage, transport, and use. The Clean Fuels Program would apply to suppliers high in the fuel distribution chain. It would not apply to retail gas stations or to users of fuel such as truckers, farmers, and other consumers. The program would not limit the amount of fuel sold, but instead is directed at reducing the greenhouse gas emissions per unit of fuel used. If phase two is triggered, the program would create demand for lower carbon fuels, some of which is likely to be produced in Oregon, as well as other states, and it would drive the development of infrastructure needed to deliver these alternative fuels. The construction and operation of these facilities would obviously create jobs, but perhaps more important, at least in the long run, the Clean Fuels Program would help to diversify Oregon's fuel supplies and redirect money being spent on imported petroleum back into our state and country. One major concern that has been raised about the Clean Fuels Program is whether it would cause the price of fuel to increase at the pump. A closely related concern is whether there will be adequate supplies of lower carbon fuels to meet the standard. First, let me assure you that neither of these outcomes could occur during phase one. That's because fuel suppliers would not be required to and during phase one to increase the distribution of lower carbon fuels. DEQ estimates that the cost of complying with phase one will be negligible when you spread that cost over the approximately 2 billion gallons of gasoline and diesel sold in Oregon annually. Before recommending whether or not to trigger phase two, DEQ would conduct a thorough assessment of the future availability of lower carbon fuels. If we determine that the supply of lower carbon fuels is inadequate, then we would recommend to the EQC that they delay triggering phase two or revise the standard so it can be met with the anticipated level of low carbon fuel supplies. If and when phase two is triggered, House Bill 2186 and DEQ's proposed rules also include safeguards to prevent any price increases or fuel supply disruptions. The standard is designed to phase in gradually so that most of the demand for lower carbon fuels would occur during the last half of the 10-year period, giving time for the new supplies to be developed. In addition, the statute directs DEQ to suspend requirements in response to unexpected or forecasted supply shortages or in response to fuel price increases that are out of line with prices in neighboring states. There are many factors that influence the price of fuel at the pump, but by diversifying the fuel supply, the Clean Fuels Program could actually help insulate fuel users from price spikes that commonly occur in petroleum fuels. For example, ethanol currently costs about $1 per gallon less than gasoline, even after adjusting for the fact that ethanol gets fewer miles per gallon than gasoline. This can reduce the impact of price spikes like the one that occurred this spring because of a fire at the BP Cherry Point refinery in Washington State. At the governor's request, DEQ is developing a rulemaking proposal for consideration by the Environmental Quality Commission at its December 2012 meeting. We have distributed draft rules to stakeholders for informal review, and we'll be meeting with them to discuss the draft rules over the next 2 months. In the next few weeks, we will convene an advisory committee to review the draft fiscal and economic impact analysis for phase one of the program. In August, we will open a formal public comment period during which we can accept written and oral testimony on the record. DEQ will hold hearings around the state, including one that is scheduled directly in front of the Environmental Quality Commission, so the public can speak directly to the commissioners. In addition to directing DEQ to proceed cautiously with the rulemaking, Governor Kitzhaber has directed us to work closely with the legislature, both to keep you informed about this proposal and to request the necessary legislative action to fully implement the program. As a result, DEQ is developing a legislative concept and budget proposal for consideration during the 2013 legislative session. One issue to be addressed in the legislative concept is the sunset. In order for the program to be successful, it is imperative that the sunset be lifted as soon as you have confidence in the rules that we're adopting and that they faithfully and meet the conditions established in House Bill 2186. This is because we need investment to occur as soon as possible to increase the production of low-carbon fuels and the infrastructure to deliver those fuels. Until the sunset is lifted, developers and investors will not be able to count on the demand created by the Clean Fuels Program. Another issue to be addressed in the legislative concept is program funding. While DEQ has developed the proposed program within existing resources, we would not be able to effectively implement the program without additional resources. Existing staff will need to resume work that has been deferred in development of the program, including work required to meet more stringent federal air quality standards that EPA has either recently adopted or is expected to adopt soon. We plan to request 1.5 positions to implement phase one, at a cost of approximately $180,000 per year for the 2013-15 biennium. The legislative concept would provide funding for these positions by authorizing DEQ to establish a fee on the fuel suppliers who are subject to the program. At this time, DEQ estimates that approximately 50 businesses would be subjected to the program, although that's an estimate that could change. DEQ is committed to working with the legislature and stakeholders as we continue development of the Oregon Clean Fuels Program. Paul and I would be happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Palmer. I'm going to start with some questions. And Palmer, because, you know, this is not my favorite subject, as you know, but because of your excellent communication skills and open path, I would compliment you and the Director Peterson. You're not going to be surprised by my questions, and I appreciate our ongoing conversation, whether it's offline or in here. So you're not going to be surprised when I ask you about other states. I think that the bill only referenced directly the state of Washington. You can say a word about that, but it's my understanding Washington's not doing this, and it was sort of, as I understood it, as I remember it, the comparison that we were using in the measurement, I guess I would say, in the bill. But more importantly than Washington, of course, I want to get to California. You can comment on both. And here we are moving ahead, which I disagreed with, and I was disappointed that the governor did. But here we are moving ahead with a pioneer low-carbon fuel standard. I think we're going to be the second because California is the first. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons that we have our other guest with us talk a little bit about it. It's hung up in court. It's being appealed. It was ruled or declared unconstitutional in a federal court, I think, and now it's being appealed, and we haven't heard. I also will note that this is a reason not to read the blogs, but right after they lifted the stay, which, as this thing unfurls, both sides create, you know, a claimed victory. But the point is, it hasn't been ruled on. I don't like to do things just because California doesn't, but I think it's very difficult for us to ignore when the big 800-pound gorilla south of us is hung up in court over its constitutionality, for us just to say, we're going ahead. Please respond.
All right. Well, Chair Gilliam, I'll start by saying I appreciate your opening comments about keeping the lines of communication open. You've been very good to give us an opportunity to talk with you, and we appreciate that as well. So I wanted that to be noted for the record. I think it's an excellent question about why we would be the second through the gate when there are legal questions surrounding California as the first place actually in the world to go forward with a program like this. I guess I'd answer in a couple different ways. On the basic issue of whether it's constitutional or not to proceed with this, and I'm going to let Paul speak to it in a little more detail, I would say obviously that's not a settled question. There is ongoing litigation. But California has been given permission by the courts to move forward with implementation. So one of the legal hurdles, which was the injunction that was placed at the federal district court, has been stayed. And so now we move on to the merits of this in terms of a constitutional question. But California is able to move forward with the program. Our program is also different than California. It mainly is different in terms of we have provisions to protect for price increases and fuel supply disruptions. And then I would also say that, as the governor indicated in his letter, he feels like it's important to move forward, understanding that there's plenty of opportunity both at the administrative level where DEQ works, and then certainly at the level of policymakers such as yourself and other legislators and the governor to work about whether we ought to move forward. But in his estimation, in his letter, he speaks to the need to start addressing climate change. We do have goals in this state calling for a reduction in our levels of greenhouse gases. And when you look at the transportation sector, we feel like this is an important way to do it, addressing cleaner fuels. There are other parts to that approach of increasing vehicle efficiency, reducing the number of miles traveled. But when you really want to look at the transportation sector, you have to consider cleaner fuels as a key component of addressing that in terms of greenhouse gases. And I single out the transportation sector only because if you look at the data, they're the largest source of emissions in Oregon today. So I think it boils down to, yes, there is uncertainty about the ultimate litigation and where that's going to go. And again, Paul may want to speak to that a little bit more. But there is a feeling, at least from the governor's office, that this is an important issue to move forward on and that we need to make progress on the goals. And the transportation sector is one of the largest components of solving that riddle. But again, I want to stress that there'll be a lot of opportunity to talk about the Clean Fuels Program as we proceed, both administratively and at the legislative level.
Palmer, I want to go back just for a second. I acknowledge that this is not an identical plan to California, and you've put a lot of work into it, and you've tailored it for our state. However, would you acknowledge that large portions of the plan or concepts of the plan are inspired by, copied from, I'm not trying to be incendiary, from California?
And Chair Gilliam, I would agree to that. I think you're absolutely right. We borrowed heavily from California to model this program. And that's why I say, again, the underlying questions in the litigation, the constitutional questions, do matter to Oregon's program. Now, one thing that we have done here is we've tried to be methodical and careful, as the governor instructed, and so we have bifurcated our rulemaking into a phase one and phase two. Phase two, if adopted by the EQC this December, would direct the EQ to get reporting data from the fuel importers and fuel distributors. And that's the extent of our authority. The question of whether there will be actual carbon reductions, which I think is really at issue, the constitutional issue in the California case, is deferred under our proposed rules, would require a second rulemaking by the EQC to actually be effective. And I would add, as we talked about, or I talked about in my testimony, there's the issue of the sunset, whether the legislature thinks that the Clean Fuels Program makes sense for Oregon. That's an issue that the legislature will be able to look at in the 2013 session, as well as the fact that we're going to need positions and fee authority to move forward.
I would add this regarding the California situation. I understand your point and appreciate it about the deferral aspect of this. But I still would not have gone ahead. That would not convince me and does not convince me, even though we're holding that aside, to go ahead with the larger program. And it gets to cost. We're not as big as California. And they predicted billions in costs here. I don't know if you could say, you know, there's a direct relationship between our size and theirs, and therefore it's 10% of California ours. But there's huge costs according to their predictions. Those don't seem to be, and it could be my mistake, but those don't seem to be reflected in your testimony, the potential for costs California anticipates.
Chair Gilliam, I would respond this way. Again, there's a phase one and the phase two. I think probably the report that you're referring to, which I think is the California Energy Commission report, looks more at the actual carbon reduction requirements, which is, and I appreciate that you acknowledge that, we've deferred to phase two of this rule. Only happens if the EQC adopts a second rule and the legislature removes the sunset and gives us the position and fee authority to move forward. So in phase one, what we're looking to do, and if the EQC adopts this rule, is to require importers of the regulated fuels in Oregon to report on their fuel mixes, their fuel volumes, and how they would calculate meeting the carbon baseline and the carbon reductions. But they don't actually have to change anything about what they sell or what they import or anything like that. So that is why in my testimony I made the comment or the statement that we feel like the cost out of phase one is very, very limited. That's not to say that there is no cost, because I think there is. There's certainly going, if again, we move forward with position authority and the fee authority and the EQC adopts a rule, there will be a fee that will have to be paid by importers. That is a cost of business that they will have to pay. So I understand that cost add up. I also understand that beyond the fee, they will have to set up systems to track, to do the calculations. So there's added cost there. So I don't want you to think that my testimony ignores the cost or that there are no costs in phase one. We just think they're much smaller when you think about the 2 billion gallons of gasoline and diesel that come to Oregon. When we come to the question of the actual carbon reductions, which are, if there is a part that could cost more, that's probably the piece. Again, I appreciate that you recognize we've talked about deferrals for the price if the price increases by more than 5% relative to neighboring states, as well as dealing with the disruptions. I think the real issue there, as I understand it, is whether there'll be enough biofuels and alternative fuels so that the industry can blend to meet the carbon reduction standards. That's a fair question because that's a question in the future. And I can't sit here today and answer it with absolute certainty. Neither could the state of California, neither can DEQ. But that is why in our process, before we move into phase two of the rulemaking, we will do a fuels assessment, which will take a look at what type of biofuels and other alternative fuels, including energy and natural gas. I don't want to exclude those. They will be part of the portfolio, part of the analysis. But we will look at those to see, are there going to be adequate supplies to meet the carbon reduction standards in phase two of the proposed rule? And if there are not, then the EQC will have the ability to defer the requirement, and that could be that it isn't a 10% over 10-year requirement. Maybe it's an 8% over 10 years. It could be that the time frame doesn't run for carbon reduction from 2015 to 2025. It could be 2017 to 2027. So that's why I made the comment earlier that within even the administrative process, setting aside the legislative discussions, within the administrative process, there's a lot of opportunity to make sure that we are proceeding cautiously and methodically, that there will be adequate supplies so the price doesn't spike up, and that if there's a question there, we can certainly do the deferrals and the other actions to protect the consumer, but that we can change the standard to reflect what's really going to happen.
All right. There's several aspects to this. Other questions? Representative Thompson.
I hate to go down this road because it's going to give the appearance that I agree with the chair and we never agree on anything. But it appears here
Representative
that
Bailey
we
is not Mr. Bailey's not here. You don't have to
a problem with timing and execution and getting tangled up in our own underwear again. We're moving ahead on this and it's great press and I understand the environmental sides of it and all of that, but EPA has already implemented a renewable fuel standard that covers biodiesel blending, all these sort of things. It's coming down nationally. Mm-hmm. So we haven't realized that benefit yet, if there is one. And connected to that, we've got the problem of not having our own house in order as we move into this. And it smacks of the potential for not switching from one fuel source to another, but simply limiting the availability of fuel. And that's going to be an enormous problem, particularly in rural Oregon. And as a specific example, in my district, I have a fledgling canola production industry. That industry is being stopped down entirely by state regulation. We cannot grow to the market that exists today. Attached to that industry is a biofuels extraction plant that can't get the raw material it needs to operate. So they're importing soybeans from China. That's the existing on the ground right now today. 100% of their waste product, the meal, is going into animal feed, and there's an open market for that. So you look at this and you go, wow, here's production, here's jobs in the oil production, the pressing, here's a market for an animal feed for the byproduct. I mean, this thing just sings when I think we were talking about creating jobs in Oregon a while back. It may not be today, but it was a topic that came up during the elections at least. Okay. What is wrong with this picture? Why are we talking about developing this new standard when we aren't doing what we could be doing that requires nothing except relaxing regulations and spurring development of what's already possible and already working? So to me, there's just a lot of lipstick and window dressing on this thing that says we're not ready to do this because we haven't done what we could already do and we're trying to move on to some other horizon. And I'm not sure that was a question. I think it was a question, but
up to you, Paul.
It might elicit a comment. I don't see why we need to do this right now when there's things we could do right now, today, this week, next week, that would make a difference in biofuels production, move us into the diversified fuel base, and then we can get off and talk about cellulosic biofuels and biomass and all those things too. That's a whole nother hour. But you know, we're just not there. We're not doing what we should be doing, and then we're trying to go to another level. I have a problem with that.
Chair Gilliam, Representative Thompson, it's a good question, and so I also.
But you recognize the question? I'm not sure.
It was a long thread, but I found the question in there. A couple of things. One, I just want to be absolutely clear, because I think you might have alluded to it in your remarks, and that is this program doesn't limit how much fuel can be sold of any type, whether we're talking gasoline, diesel, biofuels, or anything like that.
But I will. And following that, yeah, I understand. But when we're talking about switching from fossil fuels to biofuels, biodiesel, whatnot, what's the point of doing that when right now we're stopping down the production of biofuels? We can't switch to them unless we just bring them in from out of state. Which let's grow the biofuels industry, let that be picked up in the market, which we have with blending now anyway. Mm-hmm. We have willing customers for the fuel we're not allowing to be produced. And this whole thing could be market-driven while we wait for the courts to decide what they're going to do about California. I don't see it that it's do this or do nothing. It's we got a lot we could do before we get tangled up in an entirely new bailiwick of regulations.
Right. Well, again, Chair Gilliam, Representative, I think that you're absolutely right, and in this sense, you hit upon a critical issue, and I was alluding to it earlier. The Clean Fuels Program will not work if there is an adequate supply of biofuels.
Yeah.
And I hear you to be saying there's production available here in Oregon. We could get things
today
happening,
yeah,
and that state regulations are an impediment to that. That is an issue that will have to be addressed. It's outside of this rulemaking, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a role for DEQ or other state agencies to deal with that. I think what I would understand, the venue for those type of discussions would be the energy plan, the presentation you saw from Margie Hoffman. But it will not work if whether it's regulations or market barriers or other obstacles prevent us from really developing a robust enough biofuel supply to allow the industry to use those fuels to blend with gasoline and diesel. It will not work. So I acknowledge that. It rests upon that premise. So if there are things that we have to look at in Oregon to ensure that we take the sort of the raw materials and the resources we have and we can put them to use, we will certainly have to look at that. As far as sort of getting out ahead of maybe where the market is or maybe where we should be from a policy point of view, it's a fair question. It's the question that the chair asked about litigation. It's a question about whether the market in biofuels is robust enough to support and supply the fuel sources. I understand all that. That's why, again, we're trying to proceed methodically here and say before we go to phase two, which actually would require the carbon reductions, we need to do that fuel assessment. There is the secondary issue, which will fall squarely in the lap of this committee and the whole legislature, and that is of the sunset. I've heard from the biofuels industry and investors and developers in that area, their concern is if the sunset hangs over the Clean Fuels Program, it's not removed, then we don't know whether to invest in additional biofuels production, because we don't know whether this program will create the demand it proposes to for biofuels. So that's another issue that I think could be added to your issue of, do we have regulations that get in the way of taking what we have now and doing more with it? There's a lot of questions about this program and about the larger universe of energy. And so, again, our approach has just been to proceed very methodically and carefully, get the data, get the information, and have those conversations with the legislature, with the governor's office, with stakeholders about how all that works.
I mean, to go for the ridiculous to sublime, the biofuels plant in my district was built with state incentive money. At the same time, we're shutting down the supply of materials going into that plant to extract oil. I mean, we got to get that straightened out before we get too far down the road into other energy policy issues. We've got actual on-the-ground problems to deal with.
Thank you, Representative. And I'm going to go on to Representative Witt and then Representative Kinnegar, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to tell Representative Thompson that I share his frustrations over canola, and there could be an opportunity here for a bipartisan bill. Palmer, thank you very much for your presentation. I wanted to talk, with the Chair's indulgence, a little bit about opportunities and threats here. And I want to very badly come away from your presentation saying that this is a very modest proposal that provides an opportunity for those of us in rural Oregon to contribute our fair share to carbon reduction. The fact of the matter is that many of us, or most of us, a lot of us in rural Oregon tend to drive a lot more miles than do our urban counterparts. It's probably a longer distance to the grocery store, and it's usually a heck of a lot longer distance to our jobs. And so this provides us an opportunity to make our contribution. What prevents me right now from saying that this is a modest proposal is knowing with great certainty, you've talked several times about fuel supplies being critical as to whether or not we implement phase two. Fuel supply and price, the two sides of the same coin, are what are possibly preventing me from labeling this a modest proposal. And that is the certainty by which I can tell my constituents in no uncertain terms who may be paying in many, many, many instances $100 per week in commuter fuel costs that they will not realize a 25% or whatever that figure is increase in fuel costs due to this program. Now, you've told us that if there are inadequate fuel supplies, or presumably if the price goes up, that we will in some way abate this program, toll it. I'm not sure what happens. How do I provide my constituents the certainty and ironclad certainty that they do not come out the losers in this program?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, I think it's an excellent question. I think it's a question that's foremost on everybody's mind. It should be, especially when you consider that fuel prices in Oregon, I think, are the national average is maybe 50% more, 50 cents more, excuse me, than the prices in other states. And so that means that we're being adversely impacted here in Oregon relative to other places. I would answer your question in a couple of ways. When you look at the language of the draft rule itself, it has a couple of provisions that I hope provide the certainty that you're looking for. One is that in the short term, if we see that prices are going up, we have to look at the question of what is causing the price increase. I mean, we all acknowledge fuel prices fluctuate a great deal. Unfortunately, they seem to mostly fluctuate upward. Hopefully, that won't always be the case. But they fluctuate for a lot of reasons. Turmoil in the Midwest, supply disruptions, you know, all kinds of reasons. The question would be whether our program, this proposed program, would be the source of that price increase. If it is, we have in the short term the ability to halt the requirements on the importers to meet the carbon reduction requirements. We also have, as a part of this program, on a regular basis, we will be doing forecasts of the fuel supplies, looking into the future, short term, you know, 3 months, 6 months, a year out. And if we are seeing problems there, then we can go back to the commission and say there is an estimated or forecasted fuel supply problem. We may need to do something with the rule. Those are the things that are built into the rule itself to provide certainty that we're not going to see price increases. The other thing I would say is that I think the belief is the primary way to meet the carbon reductions are going to be through the blending of ethanol and biodiesel and that type of thing. Right now, and this is right now, ethanol is, I think, more than a dollar a gallon cheaper than gasoline and diesel. So at the moment, subject to change, subject to a different world and different prices in the future, but at the moment, those prices are lower, and those blending requirements should help with fuel prices and fuel spikes. But if we don't see that happen, again, we have built into the rule the ability to toll the program, as you said, to stop the program and ensure that the importers don't have to meet the carbon reduction requirements. And also we have the ability, and we will, one of the positions that we would be asking for if we go to phase two, which we would have to come back to the legislature for separate position authority, would have someone whose job it is to monitor the markets, monitor the fuel supplies, so they can report to the EQC that there are not sufficient supplies forecasted in the future.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mason is going exactly where I would hope he would go, but I'm still looking again for that ironclad guarantee where if my constituents or folks around the state who live in rural areas and face higher fuel costs to begin with than is the statewide average, when they call Uncle, if there's a way to call a timeout on this, I'm there, but I haven't heard what I'm looking for just yet.
I appreciate you asking the question and making the comment, Representative, as we have similarities in our districts. So thank you for bringing that up. Before I go to Representative Kinnegar, just because we're on this point, back to Representative Witt's question, I want to make sure I understand this. Is DEQ planning to adopt a rule on phase two in December, or you're saying you have to wait?
Chair Gilliam, I think I can explain that. We are proposing to the EQC, and it'll be ultimately their decision, to adopt a rule that includes phase one and phase two. But the language of the rule is that phase two is indefinitely deferred and cannot be implemented until the EQC takes a second affirmative action through a separate rulemaking. That's the language of the rule. There's also, as I point out to you, the issue of where the legislature ultimately stands on this question. We are not going to proceed if there's no real discussion of the sunset, and the sunset hasn't been changed or modified in some way. It wouldn't make sense to start a program that would end within a couple of years. And then also the position authority, fee authority, those type of things. So it is true, and I don't want anybody to think that we're being disingenuous. We are putting the entire rule out there, phase one and phase two, but phase two cannot take effect unless those conditions are met. And I just would quickly add, Mr. Chair, that we did that because, as I understand, and I didn't work on this issue during the 2009 session, was the expectation of DEQ is that before the legislature lifted the sunset, or if the legislature took up that question, they wanted to see the entire program. And that's why we drafted the complete rule.
Appreciate the clarification. Thank you for your patience, Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your comments, your testimony, and for the concerns you've raised. I think that I would just say that we're looking at what the possible downsides could be, and I want to also kind of remind ourselves about what the possible upsides would be. We started out with a presentation on the 10-year energy plan. We started talking about the solar siting. There was the issue of regulations. There was also the issue of how do we incentivize financing? How do we find the financing for that? You brought up the same issue with the canola. And I see this as a piece of the puzzle moving forward for the 10-year energy plan, where not only can it bring costs down, since typically the costs are lower right now for the blended oil, the blended fuel, than it is for straight gasoline, but Representative Witt, when you talked about wanting that ironclad guarantee, we will never get that with our 100% imported fuel. That, I feel like, is going to put us way more at the, you know, the variation that the market has. This is a way that we can actually spur on local economic development, create jobs, create an incentive and a market for the biofuels in your districts. I think it's a great urban-rural partnership in terms of the new biofuels hub, the three businesses that are starting in the industrial area in Northwest Portland, but also for, is it Sequential, the one that's in Eugene, Sequential?
Sequential, yeah.
Sequential has a business down there. The Ziachem, located at Boardman. These are already projects that are creating a lot of new jobs, both in urban and rural areas. And my understanding of how this program would work is since they have to reduce the carbon intensity by 10% over 10 years, if they don't purchase the biofuels and blend those, then they have to purchase credits from companies that might be building solar in your district. So I think it's a fantastic opportunity to spur local economic development, to protect ourselves from what the external marketplace might do with fuel costs. And I think you've done it in a way that has just safeguards built in at every step. You know, prices can't increase more than 5%, even though it looks like they'll decrease. We have a great upside, and we have a very limited downside in how I read how you've structured this program. So I'm very eager to see the rulemaking process go forward in a very kind of methodical, careful way. I am eager to hear the constitutional questions, because I know less about that.
Thank you, Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just comment that I truly believe in the market forces, and in my district, market forces have been responsible for three slash burners not to open, and a ethanol plant to just close in the past week. The market forces are not entirely rosy right now in terms of supply for available biofuels.
Thank you, Representative. We're going to go to Representative Bence and then Representative Thompson.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Over the assumption here is that 10% of our carbon created through transportation and the reduction of that and the elimination of that is going to do some massive good. It would be worthwhile for DEQ to explain to us what that massive good is in relative terms so that we can understand on a scale, a worldwide scale, shall we say, what we're actually achieving as a result of your optimistic and ambitious goal reflected in this statute.
Right.
And I'm going to set that aside for a moment, because it's enough that we have, for purposes of this discussion, a sense of scale and an understanding, as opposed to just the knee-jerk, oh, that's good. We need to know, in the great scheme of things, how much good and measured against what. Because there is no doubt in the world that this program, no matter how nicely you place it or state it, is going to be expensive, period. How expensive, I don't think you know. But let me give you an example. So when the 2% biodiesel requirement was implemented across the state with no regard to small rural communities and where they got their diesel, was there a study done on how much that was going to cost? The answer is no. And what we have now in my region is one blending facility, and that's where you must get your diesel. That's where you must get your diesel. That didn't used to be the case. Mm-hmm. We used to have two sources of clean diesel, and we got the lowest market price as a result of that competition. We don't have it now. Now, that was an undesirable outcome of somebody's idea of good. And so I don't view what is about going on here as necessarily good, because I don't think the DEQ has done, or the legislature in passing the law, because you're merely carrying out the law, has done, or maybe is capable of doing, and sorting through the complexities of what you're about. It is so complex, I don't even know where to start asking you questions. I really don't. And then to say that you can sort it out for us with just the few FTE you've suggested is just an embarrassment. Not that you ask, but that you ask for so little, because the consequences to us as a state are enormous. Now, if you disagree with me, if you think the consequences are not, then make the case. Now's a good time.
Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz, as usual, you always ask me very good questions, but I think they're very fair questions. Let me maybe for a moment talk about the example of the 2% biodiesel requirement. I can't speak to why a study wasn't done, but I would agree with you that that would be disconcerting. This is a little bit different, though. We feel like there has been analysis of the impact, the potential economic impact of this program. And the economic analysis that we have shows, at least in the short run, this is a positive gain to Oregon. That primarily comes through the construction and additional operation of the biofuels facilities, like the ones that have been mentioned here in testimony. So there has been some level of analysis on that issue. And I would certainly agree with you, too, that if the legislature goes forward with a program like this and there is inadequate supply of the biofuels, then that would lead to a price increase. So that scenario needs to be addressed. And there again, we feel like in the proposed rule, we have provisions that speak to that, where we do the analysis both before the second phase is adopted of the adequacy of the alternative fuels. We also have, if the second phase goes forward, a position associated, as I was explaining earlier, that would be forecasting the availability of supplies to ensure with a 12-month look that we're not going to run into this problem of where there's a single source, as you pointed out in your example, for a mandated regulated requirement. Because if we did have that, we would have a supply restriction and it would lead to price increases. So we've tried to address those issues in that way. On the larger question of where a clean fuels program fits in terms of greenhouse gas reductions, I also think that's a very fair question. I think you could say much of what we would do in Oregon, while good and perhaps even noble, would not show up in a huge economy. I mean, ecosystem. I mean, after all, greenhouse gas emissions are global, and they affect the planet in a global way. So I think the reason that, as I understand it, we're going forward with this is the belief that we have to do something about our contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, and this is a way to do it. Again, this question's been looked at, of the transportation sector being one of the larger sources of emissions in Oregon. How best do you try to deal with the emissions from the transportation sector? And this is one of the strategies that's been vetted sort of time and time again on how to do that. But that in and of itself may not be enough of a reason to do it. I think some of the other reasons are alluded to in the governor's letter and in his proposed energy plan, and that is there's value in trying to create homegrown fuel sources and trying to encourage development and production in that way, both from a dependency on other fuel sources, particularly those abroad, as well as the economic opportunities that may potentially come out of producing more fuel for use here in Oregon from Oregon. So I agree that a large part of why we're talking about this issue is the environmental, and I would agree with you, the global environmental consequence, and one has to ask how much can Oregon do to contribute to that problem. But also, there, I would suggest that there are other reasons why this program has value, and those should be noted and considered as well.
I thought you might. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to all have an opportunity to see how well a mandate for ethanol use works without the concurrent tax credit, because the federal government just did away with a tax credit for much of the biofuel industry, but it didn't do away with the requirement that we burn it. So the cost that used to be spread among all of us taxpayers is now going to be, I think, spread upon the fuel user. Setting that aside, I want to go back to something you said about the process here and the phase one, phase two. Let me just explain it as I understand it, and then you can correct me. The idea is that you would go through rulemaking on both phase one and phase two, and you would adopt both sets of rules in December of this year. You would not implement, however, the phase two rules until sometime in the future. But there is a requirement for an economic and fiscal analysis of both phase one and phase two, and you will not be able to adopt either without it. So my question is, when may we see that economic and fiscal analysis of phase two?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz, that is true. You're absolutely right that we are required to do an economic analysis of any proposed rule. We are in the process of doing the analysis for phase one of the rule. Our thought is that the economic analysis of phase two would come at the time the EQC is adopting the second rule. And at that time, we would do an analysis of the potential impacts. I think in terms of process, that would be better because we're going to learn a lot in phase one about how the industry actually determines whether how they would meet the carbon reduction requirements. They don't actually have to meet them, but they do have to calculate how they would comply with that standard. That information is going to be important, along with the assessment of whether there are actual available biofuels and when those fuels might be available, for us to figure out what the standard, the actual carbon reduction standards are going to look like in phase two. And that, I would submit to you, would be the right time to really do a detailed and thorough economic analysis, because we would really be looking at the rule that would be implemented. Right now what we have is we do have, I would say, an outline of those rules. There's actual rule language, but again, they're not going to be implemented, and they're going to be refined and sharpened as we move into phase two. So our approach is to look at that economic analysis at that time we take up the second rulemaking.
Okay, you're confusing me. And the idea is that you are going to adopt both rules in December, phase one and phase two. Is that correct?
It is one rule that includes both phases.
Okay.
Yes.
And that means in order to adopt that rule, you're going to need to do your economic and fiscal analysis of phase two before December.
Right.
Is that going to happen?
Yes, it will. But I guess to answer your question, Representative Benz, the analysis of phase two will be based on the fact that phase two isn't actually implementable until the EQC adopts a second rule. So while, again, and I'm not at all trying to be disingenuous here, but we're going to lay on the books a rule that includes phase one and phase two. But phase two is not effective in terms of actual carbon reductions. That won't happen until a second rule is adopted, if it's ever adopted.
Excuse me.
And just a second, Representative Benz, because I want to hear your comment on this.
Yes.
This is what I was trying to clarify, and I'm not sure we're getting there.
No, we're not.
But that was what my concern was in my question. You are going to move ahead with language, the adoption of language, without actually implementing that language. I'm not excited about that, but I'm just trying to help clarify this.
Well, may I, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you. Okay, I don't see how you can get there the way you're suggesting, Palmer. I don't think it'll work under the way that our laws are written. I'll just throw that out there and say, if you're going to adopt a rule, you have to do the economic and fiscal analysis. Don't forget the implementation piece, because we can do that with every rule then. Oh, someday we're gonna do this and that and the other, and then when we get around to implementing it, you're saying that we will do another complete economic and fiscal analysis before we implement the rule? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir. Before we implement the second phase, which in essence will be a new rule. And the reason I say that, Representative Benz,
why bother with your adoption of phase two in December? Why are you doing it? Right. Why bother?
It's a fair question. Again, I didn't work on this issue in 2009, but what I understood from the legislative discussion at that time was the expectation is the department would come back with the entire program to the legislature. And that was because the legislature is going to have to debate the issue of the sunset, whether we keep this program or we don't keep it. That's where the sunset issue, what it turns on. So in sort of fairness to the debate and giving the policymakers the full information, the feeling was come forward with the entire rule. So the
if I may, Mr. Chair,
please.
It's obvious we are not going to have a full debate if you haven't done the economic and fiscal analysis. I mean, that's what we're talking about up here. What's it going to cost, we're saying? What's the impact on the economy, we're saying? If you can't answer that, the rules, it's a joke. Forgive my use of it, rather. I've been distracted by the metaphorical picture of getting caught in our underwear. I can't get it out of my mind. I'm sorry, tangle.
Yeah, yeah.
Forgive me for using the word.
I tried to purge that quickly as I heard it, so no offense. So,
for once, you're speaking for the committee.
Yes.
No,
anyway.
These are good points, and these are the, from my point of view, the premature aspects, the California decision, and then this aspect of moving ahead. I think you're doing a good job of trying to explain the department's position. I appreciate that you're coming in after the bill and you're working on it in this cycle, but they're both premature in my opinion, and I'm editorializing as the co-chair. Over to Representative Thompson.
I've never heard you editorialize before.
Well,
I guess part of my frustration, and I'd ask you to look at this if it's not too late, and that is the inordinate impact these decisions have on rural Oregon. My friends in the environmental community are very open about they would love to get us all out of our cars onto buses and light rail, and I applaud that. That's great. But Representative Benz has to drive 7.5 hours to work, and he doesn't have the option of light rail or a bus. I'm more fortunate. I'm closer. I can ride the bus to the Capitol. I just have to drive 14 miles to the bus stop and then ride 2 miles on a bus. But these are big issues, and if we screw this up and the price of fuel goes up 40%, I don't get a bus near my door. What I get is a reduction in my standard of living, and that's a huge issue in rural Oregon, because any increase, including the ones we already have, in fuel prices is just devastating to the people who live there and don't have any options. I could ride a bicycle 16 miles, but if you took a good look at me, you know why that's not going to happen. You know, but, you know, come on. We've got to be sensitive to the problems throughout the state of Oregon and not just, oh, well, if fuel prices go up, more people will ride the bus. No. And I know that's part of the background discussion because I've been in those meetings. It only applies to the urban areas of Oregon, which is not most of Oregon in terms of the where the people are living. So I think this is premature. We've got other things we need to do before we can make this happen. It's a goal, but I would hate to see it become something set in stone.
No comments necessary. It's your choice. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just love to respond as one of those Portland people. I do have different choices, and I recognize that. But I, first of all, the 40%, you know, they can't go up more than 5%. There's a safeguard in there without being able to pull the plug on the program. So I want to just reiterate that point. And I do think that the concern about the downsides is very valid. I'm glad that we have that on this committee, but I'm also glad that the work group that's worked on this has looked at that very thoroughly. I also want to say, though, that we as policymakers have to look forward and look at what about the 40% of increase that could happen if you have another war in the Middle East. We need to look ahead and protect ourselves against that. And so, you know, we've had a lot of discussion here about potential downside, which I see as a really minimal risk, given the safeguards that you've put in place, given the fact that it could be pulled at any time and it could be delayed. I see it as going back to your former comment about getting our house in order and being ready for some of the federal regulations. We're getting out ahead, enabling ourselves in the phase one to start building the capacity that we need to as a state to oversee this program, but also the capacity of these 50, 100, however many it is, importers of fuel that provide the fuel for our state. for their ability to start tracking this. I see it as getting out ahead of the game because of the possible downsides if we don't. So I remain very excited about this program. I think that we need to keep it on track. We've got lots of safeguards of where we could pull it, and I think the upsides in terms of protecting the pocketbook of particularly rural people that don't have other options, when you could have gas go sky high, when we haven't done anything to build a local economy and incentivize the market to support the kinds of industries that you could have in that we could have in Portland and that you can have in the rural areas. So I just want to keep bringing it back to that, because I think we're like so focused on the downside and we're overblowing the downside given what I read here. And I just think that there's a there's another downside out there if we don't take any steps. The downside of inaction in today's world economy, I think, is tremendous.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Oh, thank you. And Representative Kenny Garmer makes some good points. And I'm not here to suggest that we ignore the challenge that our dependence on foreign oil brings. I do want to say something about this 5%, and I don't understand the proposal well enough to probably make the point I'm about to make, but I will anyway. 10%, $4 a gallon would be 40 cents. 5% would be 20. If we were going to go out right now and say we're going to impose a 20-cent gas tax, I would not be able to go back to Ontario, okay?
No.
I might as well just drive west and keep going. And so I don't know how many people up here would be willing to support a 20-cent gas tax. I'm saying, and that's what we just heard, that until we have a 20-cent increase, we don't have an automatic stop. Now, Mason, I don't know the statute well enough to make the assertion I just did. Is it wrong?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Vance, I think your comment about a 20-cent increase in gas is well taken. I don't think anybody in this economic and climate wants to see anything like that. The statute, speaking of the statute, directs DEQ to set up the program in a way that the program, as opposed to other issues that drive fuel prices, doesn't lead to a price increase. In the proposed rule, we have built in provisions that allow us to take action to stop the requirements, the carbon reduction requirements, which is, again, this whole distinction of phase one, phase two. So we're talking about in phase two, that second rulemaking, that would allow us to stop the program from going forward, and it would relieve the importers from the obligation of meeting their carbon reduction standards. And that can happen immediately and to prevent. The 5%, and Paul, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think the 5% speaks to the looking over the 12-month period for the future supplies, the forecasted supplies of available biofuels and other things that help the industry meet the carbon reduction requirements. But we do have language in the rule to immediately stop or toll the program if there is a price increase attributable to the program.
Thank you.
Yeah. Palmer, one more question on regulation. We had Representative Thompson's comment on regulation in other departments, and we're holding you responsible for DEQ, the state of California, and Department of Agriculture. But back to the department.
I'll try not to tangle up in my underwear on that one. So
how we have just gotten that out of our. I'm interested, going back to the proposal on reporting, because there already are reporting requirements to other agencies. So say a little bit about how we could streamline this and not just be redundant, add more burden to folks that have to report.
Chair Gilliam, I think that is a good issue. I think we at DEQ need to look closer at what fuel producers and importers have to already supply to the Oregon Department of Transportation. My understanding is they mostly submit information around fuel taxes and vehicle weight miles. The information that we're looking for is a little different in this reporting, this phase one of the rule. It would certainly be the volume of fuel, but also perhaps this is more to the point, the fuel types of mix, and where they got the fuel. There's a difference between ethanol produced, perhaps, whether it's produced here in Oregon or regionally versus where it may come from Brazil or from the Midwest. I mean, all those things over a life cycle analysis factor into the amount of carbon that's in that particular fuel. So we would want to know where the fuel came from. And then thirdly, we would want to know how they're calculating their fuel mix is meeting the carbon reduction requirements. And I'll just maybe belabor this point a little bit. They would have to do those calculations under the proposed rule. But again, they would not actually have to meet the carbon reduction requirements that are sequenced over time. They would just have to report on how the fuel mix and the fuel volumes meet the calculations. So that information is different than what is currently supplied to ODOT, but if there is a way for us to use the forms that ODOT has, we certainly should be looking at that. That would streamline the process, and that issue has been raised by stakeholders, and it's a good one.
Thank you, Palmer. Colleagues, we've spent a lot of time on this, but if you have another comment or a question, I would entertain it. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly think that this is an area that we have to pursue carbon reduction. It's absolutely critical. I think there are a few things that we need to tweak. I think hydrogen opportunities offer
all the time you need.
And I also think there are some opportunities to provide some additional protections to rural Oregonians that, if we pursued those, would perhaps get us over the hump here. Thank you,
Representative. Others?
Seeing none, thank you. If you get paid by the hour, it's a pretty good gig.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if we're going to hear from the Department of Justice.
No, we just like justice to come. We don't like to hear from them. I didn't mean to cut you off if you had any other comments, sir.
Yeah, Co-Chair Gilliam and Representative Kenny Geyer, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. It sounded like you wanted to hear perhaps about the status of the lawsuits in California. So to that question, as many of you have alluded to already, a group of plaintiffs did file suit against California in the federal district court in California several years ago, challenging the California low carbon fuel standard as unconstitutional. The district court did rule in the plaintiff's favor earlier this year and enjoined the implementation of the California low carbon fuel standard. The California state government appealed that decision to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Ninth Circuit then stayed the district court's decision, which essentially allows the California Air Resources Board to implement the low carbon fuel standard until the Federal Court of Appeals makes its final decision on the merits about whether the California regulation should be upheld or struck down. So at this point, the status quo is that the California government can influence its low carbon fuel standard. The Federal District Court's decision, of course, in California is not binding in the state of Oregon, but the Ninth Circuit's decision will be, and we at the Department of Justice are actively watching this case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what the timetable is for the Federal Court of Appeals?
Yeah, Chair Gilliam and Representative Kenny Geyer, the briefing for the California, or for the Federal Court of Appeals process will begin in June. If I recall correctly off the top of my head, it wraps up in July or August, and then the court is under no specific deadline to make its decision, but we'd expect a decision from the court sometime between the fall of this year and perhaps another year or year and a half, depending on how long the court takes to decide the case.
Thank you, Mr. Logan, for being with us as well. We're going to move on to the next subject. And that subject is fish. And it's the gill netting in Sturgeon Sanctuary. And I'm going to ask Bruce Pauley to come first. Colleagues, in the interest of time and fairness, and for those that are testifying, Bruce,
6 weeks.
Roughly, I'd like to give you 7 or 8 minutes in that range, if you can use it. And for the other side, for Jim Wells and Bruce Buckmeister, you both are welcome, but we're going to stick to about that same 7 or 8 minutes. Is that okay? I'm not going to be strict, but that's just your parameter, all right? Yeah. Kick us off here, Mr. Pauley, and identify for the record. Thank you.
Chair
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Pauly from Sherwood, Oregon. I'm a volunteer with the Coastal Conservation Association of Oregon. We come to you today to discuss a serious issue of ODFW's continued approval of use of gill nets in the sturgeon spawning sanctuary below Bonneville Dam on the Columbia River. For the past 4 years, CCA Oregon and Washington have been bringing the serious decline of white sturgeon populations on the Columbia River to the attention of fisheries managers, the Fish and Wildlife Commissions, and the public. Recent studies have shown the recruitment of younger age to class sturgeon to be at historic low levels. This plight of sturgeon has found some attention in the press recently, but the fish need more help. CCA members in both states have advocated for the increased conservation measures on the Columbia to reverse the current decline of populations of not only legal-sized fish, but also recruitment of younger age class fish that are the future of our fisheries. CCA endorsed the establishment of the sanctuary as well as another sanctuary on the Willamette River to protect the breeding sturgeon during a time when undue stress can harm spawning fitness. For example, for the past 3 years, CCA has asked the Fish and Wildlife Commissions on both sides of the river to cut harvest significantly beyond the levels proposed by the departments. We did this despite the fact that the vast majority of the reductions would come from the sport fishing side. We believe this is appropriate given the drastic declines of sturgeon populations, and we're pleased that the commissions adopted the harvest levels below those proposed by the agency staff. Our members also backed the establishment of the 9.5-mile Columbia River Sanctuary below Bonneville, as well as another sanctuary on the Willamette River to protect breeding sturgeon. We supported these sanctuaries despite the fact that they came at great cost to recreational anglers. Thousands of angler trips per year were shut down. Both catch-and-keep fisheries and very popular catch-and-release fisheries were eliminated. Again, sport anglers made this sacrifice for the needs of our fisheries resources and the desire to see their populations recover and increase. After hearing all this, you may understand why we were shocked earlier this year to find that gill nets are still being used in a large majority of the Bonneville Sanctuary, which is in place from May through August. During CCA's January 6th testimony, we brought this issue before the ODFW Commission and asked to have the use of gill nets in the sanctuary stopped. During the January 6th ODFW Commission meeting, ODFW staff answered questions raised by the Commission members saying that both sport and commercial fisheries have incidental catch of sturgeon in the sanctuary. Our members were so outraged by the glossing over this clear double standard that hundreds of them wrote to the Commission members and Director Elliker of ODFW asking for gill nets to be removed from the sturgeon spawning sanctuary immediately. That outcry by CCA members led to a meeting between ODFW and WDFW staff and CCA members and staff from both states. During that meeting, we verified. It is currently illegal for a sport angler to target sturgeon in the sanctuary during the affected times of the year. It is currently illegal for a sport angler to retain any sturgeon incidentally caught in the sanctuary during salmon or other fisheries. It is currently illegal for a sport angler to use gear designed to catch sturgeon within the spawning sanctuary. It is currently legal to use gill nets within the spawning sanctuary, and last year 11 days of commercial gill netting were permitted during so-called salmon fisheries within the sanctuary. The gill net fleet can legally target sturgeon within the spawning sanctuary during these fisheries. The gill net fleet can retain and sell sturgeon caught in the spawning sanctuary. The gill net fleet could access their entire salmon and sturgeon quota without netting in the sanctuary. The ODFW Commission and staff could move the gill net fleet outside of the sanctuary with a simple boundary change of 5 miles if they chose. There is no plan by ODFW simply to move the gill nets outside of the spawning sanctuary for 2012. Those 9 points, just to verify, are points that we agreed after the meeting was over that we all came to the agreement that those were all facts. Survey data from ODFW shows that the elimination of the targeted sturgeon sport fishery in the sanctuary has significantly reduced mortality and stress to brooder sturgeon. In a recent letter to Representative Kennemer on this subject, Director Elliker of ODFW said, and I quote, "Current fisheries regulations have greatly reduced the incidental handling of broodstock sturgeon in the sanctuary, and there is no evidence to suggest that current level of incidental handling is having a negative impact on the broodstock population or that it constitutes a significant conservation risk to the white sturgeon productivity. Contrast the sacrifices asked of sport anglers and the resulting positive benefit to broodstock sturgeon with the lack of any such action by ODFW for the gillnet fleet. Gill nets, by their design, do not recognize the difference in species of the fish they encounter. In fact, the majority of sturgeon harvested in the Columbia River gill net fisheries are harvested during salmon seasons while targeting salmon.
Observations of gill nets in Zone 4 and 5, which include the sanctuary, showed nearly a 1-to-1 ratio of sturgeon to salmon caught in gill nets in observed gill net fisheries during the 2010-2011 seasons. The same observer data also showed a high bycatch of oversized sturgeon in both zones. With the concentration of spotting sturgeon in the sanctuary area, it would be reasonable to assume that bycatch of brooder sturgeon is even higher. If the original purpose of the sturgeon sanctuary was to reduce the overall stress on oversized sturgeon spawning females, how does it make sense to permit these fisheries in this area? You may hear ODFW staff and the gillnet fleet themselves claim that sport anglers catch sturgeon incidentally as well. But the simple reality is, it is illegal for sport anglers to target or retain sturgeon in the sanctuary. Incidental catch of sturgeon is also very rare, as no sport angler wants to risk losing their favorite lure or a hook of broodstock sturgeon on gear designed for salmon, pike, minnow, or shad. Without the heavy sport gear now illegal, a sport angler either loses the fight quickly or loses their gear. So the simple reality is, sport anglers simply avoid encountering sturgeon by altering their gear, their methods, or the areas fished. That is why our members are outraged that the fisheries managers refused to immediately move gill nets out of the sanctuary. By the agency's own admission, the gill net fleet's salmon and sturgeon quotas could be accessed outside of the sanctuary. The key issue before you today is one of fairness and ensuring that we all have a stake in the conservation of sturgeon. Instead of engaging in this discussion, some have resorted to misleading people in this building with pictures from sturgeon fisheries in Idaho that bear no resemblance to the Columbia River sturgeon fishery. The targeting of all sturgeon and the gear depicted in those pictures have been banned from the sanctuary, so any sport fisher could and should be cited immediately if such gear were being used. It seems even more outrageous that the individuals who continue to harvest and sell sturgeon within the sanctuary could use such deceptive tactics to mask this issue rather than just willingly moving five miles downriver. Thousands of CCA members from Oregon to Washington have shown that they are willing to make sacrifices for sustainable fisheries. We're also fed up with this double standard. We thank you for your help, and in sending this message to our fisheries managers, asking them to put the needs of our fish before the convenience of a handful of commercial interests.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. You're open to questions.
I am.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the statements that you make in your testimony is that the majority of sturgeon harvested in gillnet fisheries on the Columbia are harvested during salmon seasons?
Yes, sir.
Can you explain that?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, there are allowances that allow gillnetters to keep a limited number of sturgeon while they're salmon fishing. And as it so turns out, the quotas have been reduced greatly over the last few years with the decline of sturgeon. And in the recent years, the majority of the sturgeon that are caught in the Columbia by the gillnet fleet, by ODFW records, are caught incidentally during salmon seasons in the gillnets while they're salmon fishing, even though it's legal for them to keep them.
Mr. Chairman.
Please.
So we're talking the broad Columbia, not the sanctuary in this instance.
Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, that's correct. But the point of making that clear is that the nets catch salmon and sturgeon in the same water at the same time. And to make the point of what the bycatch really is, the majority of the sturgeon caught by gill nets are caught during salmon seasons while targeting salmon, caught for sale.
But your testimony is targeting the sanctuary, is it not?
It is.
And yet you have made reference to misleading statements by others in this building, particularly in Idaho. And, sir, I find this equally misleading.
The point of saying that the majority of the sturgeon are caught during salmon seasons is to show the lack of discernment of a gill net when it's in the water, the inability for it to selectively fish one species of fish compared to another. That was the point of making that point. The references to Idaho were the pictures that have been distributed recently about sport gear being used on fisheries by the gillnet fleet, by sport fishers. And those pictures were from, and the information on those pictures were from the state of Idaho, where it's a completely different fishery than the Columbia River.
Mr. Chairman, I would just note that as far as I know, hooks are not selective means of fishing tackle either. Thank you.
Other comments or questions? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony, and we'll move on to the other side. And where are two? We have a second, Bruce. Give me a moment. Jim Wells and Bruce Buckmaster.
Co-Chair Gilliam and representatives, my name's Jim Wells from Astoria. Lifetime commercial fisherman, been involved in lots of different commercial fisheries, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, even down in California. I'm also the president of Salmon for All. It's a volunteer position. It's our advocacy group for the gillnet fleet and the processors in the Columbia River. This first thing I want to say is it's kind of off the subject, but I want to congratulate Representative Boone on House Bill 4068, the bycatch bill, provided a solution to hunger out in our area. And we're very proud of that bill, and we appreciate it very much. A little bit of history, why we're here today. The winter sturgeon season, it's a target sturgeon season, 2011 winter sturgeon season. We had 80 salmon caught and 50 sturgeon is all. It was a very down year. And CCA, Coastal Conservation Association, tried to close our 2012 season, citing a conservation concern. Sports industry catches tens of thousands of spring salmon a year, thousands of sturgeon, and yet our 80 and 50 seem to be a conservation problem. That was fully vetted at the Fish and Wildlife Commission and through the staff. No action was taken. It was deemed to be a non-issue. Now we're on to gillnetting in the sanctuary. Give you a packet of questions that we put to the state agencies, Fish and Game Department, and there was 14 questions, and I'm only going to talk about three of them here briefly. Look, there's questions first and then some answers after two pages. On gillnetting in the sanctuary, that issue's been fully vetted with the Fish and Wildlife staff and the commission, and no action taken, and it was a non-issue as far as the commission was concerned. Number two question on there is, why was the sanctuary started in the first place? And 90 to 95, there was like 3,600 oversized sturgeon handled in that sanctuary in the sport fishery. And by 96 to 2003, the state figured that had grown up to 5,000 fish a year that was getting played by the sport fishery in the sanctuary area. That compares to like 50 sturgeon that Fish and Game estimates now that the gillnet fleet handles in that sanctuary area a year, 50 or less. It was up to 5,000 being handled. There was a lot of oversized dead sturgeon being found on the beaches with hooks protruding from their stomachs. They're obviously killed from hooking mortality. And so they decided something had to be done. And so the sanctuary was introduced to help alleviate that problem. And it was nothing to do with the gillnet fishery at all. So that was the reason it was set up. The question, answer to question number one, they've done annual tagging. The states do the sturgeon tagging program using gillnets. They hire gillnetters to do it, to tell what the biomass is in the river. By department figures, the tagging back to 1986 to 2011, there's been over 92,000 sturgeon handled through the gillnets in the tagging program. There's been 20 immediate mortalities out of 92,000 fish. That's state numbers with state observers on the boats watching every drift. We also did a study where 184 fish were taken out of the gillnets, put in our salmon net pens that were empty of salmon smolts, held for 48 hours, looked at after 48 hours, not one mortality. The sentence says, all sturgeon were considered healthy after 24 hours in the net pens and upon their release 48 hours after capture. So there's a track record on gillnets and sturgeon, and that's state figures. As far as conservation goes, and Mr. Pauly talked about the pictures from Idaho, and they are pictures from Idaho, a Idaho study, and we said that when we showed it to the commission. This is Idaho. But these are hooks. They're J-hooks, the same kind of gear the sport industry uses in the Columbia River. And what they found up there, they took a wand, a metal detector wand, over the stomach of the sturgeon that they handled and caught, beeped off. They couldn't prove it was a hook, so they went and got a portable X-ray machine and ran it through, and they were hooks in the fish. Over 31% of all the fish captured had hooks in them. And of sturgeon 5 feet and over, their spawning age class, over 50% had ingested hooks in their stomachs. So there's some pictures that I included in the back. And these are the ones he was talking about. If you go to the back of the packet, you see a sturgeon with its stomach ruptured out. And then to the left is the hooks coming out of the stomach. Now, whether that sturgeon's in Idaho or the upper Columbia River Gorge, that is why the sanctuary was introduced. Those kind of fish were showing up on the banks of the river. And the next one behind it is the X-ray photo of the hooks. And I think this particular fish has 12 to 14 hooks ingested in its stomach. Swallowed the bait and was broken off. So, you know, when he talks about gillnets being damaging to sturgeon, there's another look at the other side of the story. So CCA has all this information about the negative impacts of the recreational fishery on sturgeon, but continues to focus only on the commercial fishery. I think a rational person would think that a true conservation group would focus on all user groups involved and take appropriate action. The CCA's only agenda is to remove commercial fishing from the Columbia River and promote 100% sport fishing. Oh, thank you.
Colleagues, I'm going to hold questions so we can hear from Mr. Buckmaster first.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam. Representatives, my name is Bruce Buckmaster. I'm from Astoria, Oregon. I'm a retired businessman, now a community activist, lifelong sport fisherman, and a late and addition to the commercial fishing industry. Most of my time is spent on community advocacy, and that's why I became involved with Salmon for All. Conservation is important to Oregon, it's important to Oregonians, and frankly, I don't like to see it used as a political pawn in the allocation game, and I apologize, but that appears to be why we're here today, taking up your time. Yesterday, I did a Google search for the keywords Oregon guide oversized sturgeon, and I got 409,000 hits. In the first three pages, I have, and I gave you a copy of it, 25 websites of guides in fishing for Oregon for oversized sturgeon. These are the breeding sturgeon. I included one of the pages or an excerpt from one of the pages in my packet for you. This activity is still going on, but to be fair, I don't know if this is a conservation issue. I don't. We have a very well trained and dedicated department that works on these issues. We have a commission that looks at the recommendations made by their scientists and their department people to make final rulings on how we should fish. As Jim mentioned, the sturgeon sanctuary was created because of this, creating a small area for these breeding fish. The department, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't understand why we're seeing numbers on sturgeon dramatically drop. They've not attributed that to certainly not the gillnet fishery, and to a very limited extent only to the sanctuary, saying that they're doing something proactively for the sport fishing. Both sport and commercial still fish in that sanctuary for salmon. That's what we're doing there. And as Jim mentioned, we only catch about 50 oversized. Now, those of you who have had the joy and pleasure of being on a gillnet boat will tell you that an oversized sturgeon generally just goes right through the net, much like a sea lion or a seal. I was going to make the comment that hooks by design do not distinguish by species. Consequently, one of the ways that salmon fishing is done, sport salmon fishing in the sanctuary, if you use wrap bait, a lure with a herring wrap, then sometimes, not often, we catch sturgeon there too. All of these issues need to be addressed by the department. That's what we have them for. They are prepared, I believe, and Kurt can talk about it later, but I believe that a new sturgeon plan is in the works. It should be out next year for the commission to work at. Salmon for All advocates looking at everything regarding sturgeon. Certainly we know that stellar sea lions are impacting the breeding sturgeon. We want them to look at the issues on sport fishing. We happily have them relook at any impact that our commercial fishery may have them. But because of family fishing businesses that make their livelihoods feeding Oregon and are a critical part of the lower Columbia River, believe in conservation and believe in sustainability. That's our livelihoods, and that's how we move forward. So I'd like to thank you for your time. I'm sorry we've had to waste it with this, and we would recommend that the department continue to do its job, look at all ways, and any help we can give them, we intend to continue. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to hear from the department, as you alluded to, in just a moment. Before we do, I want to clarify, if we can, something. And this is particularly for Mr. Wells. Now, your representatives in this building are honest, and they're not deceptive. And when they came to my office, they indicated that the pictures that they were showing were from Idaho. So I just want to make sure everybody understands that. But is it your understanding that the hooks, which are not discriminant, to your point, Representative, the hooks and the gear depicted in those pictures are banned here? I don't know how likely it is. I would imagine unlikely that sports fishermen would still be using that type of gear. I think that's worth clarifying when we talk about the pictures that were distributed. What say you, Mr.
Are you asking me if that type of gear is banned?
That's my first part of my question, yes, sir.
To my best of my knowledge, no, it's not. The J-hook, that Idaho studies, the J-hook versus a circle hook. I've been a longline fisherman for many years, halibut and black cod. We switched over in Alaska 15 years ago from J-hooks to circle hooks. J-hooks get swallowed, like you're seeing in the picture. Circle hooks always lip hook. When you get a fish that's too small, undersized, reach down, twist the hook out, away it goes. Okay. Not swallowed. And they're still using J-hooks in their river.
Okay, thank you. And Kurt, that's something I'd hope that you'll address when you come up. Are there other questions for the Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just as I sought clarification in the earlier testimony, I want to be very clear here. The fishing that you described in the sanctuary, is that the sports fishermen pursue. What species are they fishing for there?
The sport fishermen in sanctuary?
Yes.
Salmon.
Okay.
Primarily salmon.
And the species that the gillnetters would be pursuing in the sanctuaries are what species?
That's salmon as well. That's where it's a target salmon fishery.
Chair Gill, Representative Witt, I think it's important to note that, yes, we could catch these fish elsewhere at other times of the year. We could release. We are not keeping oversized salmon. That has to be mentioned here. Those are we have a very specific legal salmon. When we catch those while we're salmon fishing in the sanctuary, in that part of the river, and they are legal, we are allowed to keep them.
Sturgeon.
The sturgeon, excuse me. Thank you, Jim. So we're not targeting them. They are incidental. They're part of what we catch. If they are legal, we keep them. There's no reason to release and then handle again to open up additional fishing. It's the efficiency. It's actually a conservation issue. Thank you.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, just so I can be very, very clear here, you have been criticized for fishing in a sanctuary, and your targeted species is salmon when you're fishing there.
Yes.
And as far as we know, when sports fishers are also fishing in that sanctuary, their targeted species is salmon.
Yes.
Thank you. Earlier testimony, Mr. Chairman, said that the gillnet fleet can legally target sturgeon within the spawning sanctuary during these fisheries, quote unquote. Is that an accurate statement?
You can legally target sturgeon in the sanctuary?
The gillnet fleet can legally target sturgeon within the spawning sanctuary during these fisheries. It's point number five in the earlier testimony.
Just a little bit of history. The allocation between the sport and the commercial, it all depends on who has the allocation. Between the sport and commercial, given by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, 80% sport, 20% commercial. So a few years ago, we had like 40,000 sturgeon that could be harvested out of the river. So that was like 32,000 to the sport industry, 8,000 to the commercial industry to put out on the market. It's since dropped down, and it's dropped twice. And we're down now to where the commercial industry, because they only have 20%, has such a small yearly quota of sturgeon, we're on a fishing sturgeon per week quota to go along with our salmon. We set our seasons, we're fishing salmon, to try to make our sturgeon last. You know, we got winter sturgeon, we got spring salmon, we got summer salmon, we got fall salmon. We mix a few sturgeon in each one of those seasons. To make them last throughout the year and spread them out on the market so you don't glut the market with too much fish at once, right? So we got such a small amount. We're down sometimes to two or three sturgeon a week. And when we're fishing up in that sanctuary now, we're selling probably, even if you get the two or three sturgeon, you can sell, and that's all we're getting. We're not targeting sturgeon because we can't sell them. We don't want them.
So one of the clarifications is, saying here is, it's the word target. So it's legal for you to take sturgeon. I understand your testimony to be that it is not legal for you to target. Is that what you're saying?
Right. We have no intention of targeting sturgeon there. We don't want to handle them. But if you get your two or three, you are legal to sell those on your weekly landing limit.
Is that a fair clarification?
That's exactly what I was after, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for making that clarification.
Representative Kindergar, you're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're allowed a certain legal amount for sturgeon. After that point, in order to not go over that limit, do you have to stop fishing?
You don't stop fishing.
Yeah.
But it's immediate release. As soon as that sturgeon's picked, it's back into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And that alludes back to those two studies I showed you, and over 92,000 handled with 20 mortalities. And the states do their complete biomass tagging surveys out of gill nets because they're convinced that the mortality rate out of those nets is so low.
Okay.
So when we get a sturgeon, if you got your weekly limit and you got, you know, your three or four or five or whatever that limit could be, it goes immediately back into the water once it's picked.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, and with apologies to my colleague and neighbor, Representative Witt, these guys are his constituents now. After the first of the year, they'll be mine, so I'd like to say I hope I don't see you again until you're mine, but welcome. Welcome here, and thanks for making the trip down.
Thank you. thanks for your work on the bycatch bill.
Thank
it means
you.
A lot out there.
Well, I had a lot of help. Thank you very much for your noticing that. Thanks.
All right. I'm very interested in our next guest. Thank you for your testimony, both of you.
Thank you very much.
And you're welcome. Kurt Melcher, from our friend from the department's coming up. And we've got several questions, but we're going to start with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I do have a PowerPoint here. I think it's about 12 slides long. Provided a photocopy version for you as well. And I will proceed quickly through this PowerPoint, Mr. Chair, and then be happy to answer any questions. I did want to mention a couple of things before I started off on the PowerPoint. I've worked for the department now for almost 26 years. I started my career on the Columbia River. I spent the first roughly 15 years of my career working on the Columbia River sport fishery project. I worked in commercial fisheries on the Columbia as well, and I was actually a field staff person as well as an analytical staff person during the late 80s and 1990s as this recreational fishery developed for oversized sturgeon. So with that, I'm going to proceed through this. As I said, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go quickly. I know it's getting late in the day, and I'll try not to bore you all to death.
You will.
Thank you. So briefly, then, the things that I want to cover today, and as I said, I will do it briefly. I want to talk a little bit about white sturgeon biology to just give you a little bit of the background, lay of the land there. Talk a little bit about the sanctuary. You've heard a lot about it already. I want to talk also with respect to the sanctuary. I want to talk a little bit about the current regulations and how those came about and why, as you heard during the public comment here, during the previous speakers, why those regulations differ between fisheries. Just show a brief summary of the 2011 fisheries that occurred in the sanctuary and talk a little bit about what the commission did direct us to do and what our process is here moving forward this year. So white sturgeon biology, white sturgeon are one of 25 sturgeon species worldwide. I think they are probably unarguably the healthiest population of sturgeon on the planet, certainly the healthiest in North America and one of two species on the West Coast. They can reach lengths in excess of 10 feet and over 1,000 pounds. Not terribly uncommon that they would live to exceed 100 years of age. They do reach sexual maturity at a fairly late stage compared to some other species, with males maturing at age 10 to 15 years and females maturing at age 15 to 25 years. Incidentally, the size limits that we have in place are designed with a maximum size limit as well as a minimum size limit, and the size limit is designed to protect, in fact, those oversized fish, those fish that reach the size when they are potential spawners. White sturgeon do have the ability to move between fresh water and salt water, and they do that on a relatively routine basis, many times without a lot of predictability. We'll see emigration and immigration from the Columbia Basin without really the ability to predict that in advance. Unlike salmon, we kind of know when they're coming and in terms of their annual migration timing. Sturgeon do spawn in fresh water, and we've heard, and the focus of the discussion here today is on the sanctuary. Sturgeon spawn in fresh water. Their spawning requirements are very specific, and they require a free-flowing river with a minimum flow rate as well as a rocky substrate for a bottom. So in general, all of our spawning areas on the Columbia now are in tail races immediately downstream from dams, and the largest population in the basin is the population downstream from Bonneville, and it spawns basically in those river miles immediately below Bonneville. We do have, and have recently discovered in the last 5 years, a spawning population now in the Willamette. So we have confirmed several years ago that we do have sturgeon spawning in the Willamette immediately downstream from Willamette Falls. And we had suspected it for some time, but it was recently confirmed. Females do not spawn every year. Males are capable of spawning every year. Females, due to the energy that it takes to put into egg development, spawn once every 3 to 5 years. They can produce, and again, the fecundity is really generally related to body size. So generally speaking, the larger the sturgeon, the more eggs it will have the capability to produce. Mature females produce between 100,000, and we've documented up to 7 million eggs in one individual. Spawning occurs primarily during the months of May and June, again in that tail race. It can extend into July, and it's largely dependent on water temperature and flows in the basin. These individuals evolved really in the same environment as salmon, and so that same peak flow, I think perhaps it was, well, I can't remember which committee it was yesterday, they were discussing the peak flows in the Columbia during May and June that benefit the smolt out-migration. Those are the same peak flows that benefit sturgeon and in their reproduction. So why the spawning sanctuary? And this was alluded to, so I won't dwell on this too much, but beginning in the late 1980s, recreational anglers began targeting sturgeon in the area downstream from Bonneville Dam. Over the course of several years and into the 1990s, they actually became quite effective at targeting and handling oversized sturgeon, catching and releasing oversized sturgeon. And the numbers I think somebody mentioned here earlier were by the late 1990s, we were estimating an annual handle of about 5,000 white sturgeon per year in the recreational fishery. This was truly, the commercial fisheries went on in the area over the course of those same decades. The recreational fisheries for shad, walleye, steelhead, salmon, warm water species continued to occur in the sanctuary. The real expansion in harvest, the real expansion in handle of oversized sturgeon occurred in a directed fishery. The handle, as was alluded to by both the earlier commenters, raised a lot of concerns. Staff made a number of attempts to implement a sanctuary, and in the early years, the commission declined. There was a lot of public testimony in opposition to establishing a sanctuary. It took several years, but we did ultimately get the sanctuary adopted in, I want to say it was originally in 1996, we'll have to... I think I have that in a later slide. And again, alluded to earlier, I'm probably just repeating what you heard, but the studies have shown that catching and releasing these, in particular mature sturgeon, immediately before or during spawning or immediately after spawning can lead to both failed spawning attempts as well as direct mortality. We did a lot of work in the 1990s as that fishery developed looking at sturgeon mortalities. An interesting side note, when I started my career in the 1980s, it was fairly uncommon that we would find an oversized sturgeon in the middle of the river floating, or someone would call us. Maybe once a year we'd get a call and I'd be the guy that got sent out to Savi Island or somewhere in the gorge to go find the dead, 10-foot sturgeon. And by the mid-1990s, it was commonplace. In fact, we were receiving multiple calls per week on sightings of dead oversized sturgeon. We initiated a project to essentially look at those fish, determine what the cause of death was, and hopefully take appropriate management actions, which is really the genesis of the sanctuary.
Okay. This was from what cause?
The mortality?
Yeah.
From
what method of catch and release?
Oh, yes. It was from catch and release fishing. Exactly.
From the recreation?
Yes. A high proportion of the fish that we observed, and we did not have the technology of X-ray machines or ultrasound. We had the old school, boots on the ground, dissection, try and find a hook. And I don't remember the exact proportion, but I want to say about half of the carcasses that we found had hooks still in them, many in lethal locations, some not in lethal locations. So certainly some of the fish died. Fish do die. They get old. Some of them are going to die from other causes. But as we've moved forward with implementation of the sanctuary, we see we're back down to the kind of the background level of very few oversized sturgeon mortalities that we observe, and the surveys have continued.
you know, Kurt, while we're stopped and you're talking about hooks, do you want to address the hooks that are banned and the likelihood of those kind of hooks being used?
Yeah, Chair Gilliam, and I do recall seeing the information that was handed to the commission. I don't recall what specific hooks were in the photos. J-hooks are certainly legal in the Columbia River, as are circle hooks. J-hooks are legal gear. We do have a number of requirements, though, on sturgeon, so it may be the case where both are correct. We require barbless hooks in the Columbia. Perhaps the hooks in the picture were barbed. I don't know. We do require single point and single hooks. So a recreational angler who's fishing for sturgeon cannot use a treble hook, cannot use two hooks on one bait. It's got to be a single hook, single point, barbless. So we do have those rules, but we do allow J-hooks.
Okay. At your convenience, if you would look at the material that's being referenced, and then just if there's a further comment you'd have looking at that regarding what's allowed now, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Do you want me to do that here? Today or
no,
okay,
didn't
very good.
Kurt, one of the pictures that we were given in an earlier testimony, I think the reference was to possibly a dozen hooks in the gut of the sturgeon. Is it typical for a hook to break off in the fish's gut every time it's caught?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, no, I think there's, as in anything, there is a broad spectrum of issues and circumstances related to that. Many, many times some of these hooks, and some of the hooks that we may have found when we were doing our surveys, were clearly not sturgeon-directed hooks. Some of them were related to salmon fishing or shad fishing. There's a broad range of hook wound locations. It's certainly not... Most anglers do not have the intention of gut hooking a sturgeon. Sometimes when baits get lost, so when an angler breaks off a bait because they get snagged on the bottom, a sturgeon may later ingest that hook. So in that case, it would go to the gut.
Mm-hmm.
The fish may never have been hooked on recreational tackle. It may have just been a byproduct of other activities.
I think we saw other photos of hookings other place in the fish. Is it reasonable to assume that a fish may have been hooked several times? For every time there's a visible hook in the fish, that fish may have been caught several times per hook? In other words, the number of times that fish has been caught is probably or could be vastly greater than the number of hook wounds that we're seeing?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, I'm going to say I don't know if that's reasonable to assume or not. And there's a broad spectrum surrounding these issues. I think the encounter rate, the number of times that an individual fish gets handled, is a function really of the total population size.
Mm-hmm.
So just because he found one with a hook in it doesn't mean he was handled 10 other times. It might just mean he was handled with a mortal wound as a result of that hooking. So there's a whole lot of variables, and I'm sorry to be very non-committal on that, but there's a whole lot of variables that I wouldn't be comfortable just saying if you find one dead with a hook, he was probably handled multiple times.
Okay.
If you find one with multiple hooks, good chance he was handled multiple times. And your perspective is really important. It may be that if you find them with multiple hooks in some cases, well, that means they're surviving.
Well,
they're being caught and released, and they're surviving to carry on.
Certainly, but with respect to this specific study that you have here, why the spawning sanctuary, studies have shown handling stress can interrupt spawning. Is it correct to assume that multiple catchings lead to additional spawning interruptions? The more they're caught, the more interruptions there are?
Yeah. Chair Gilliam, Representative, absolutely. And I think I maybe was not direct enough in this description here, but in addition to just the direct mortality, you know, a fish has a wound that's in a mortal area and subsequently dies. There's also the impact of, as it's been documented, of the stress associated with catching and releasing a fish can lead a fish that's in the course of maturing to actually stop maturing and resorb those eggs. So even though the fish did not die, it actually, its spawning was influenced to the point where it did not spawn that year when it was originally intended to.
I didn't catch what you said would happen to those eggs, possibly.
They would be resorbed into the sturgeon. And basically, the energy that was put into those eggs is resorbed into the sturgeon, and then it would later mature at another date, in another year, essentially, or subsequent, some number of years subsequent.
Mr. Chairman, is this normal? I mean,
Chair Gilliam, Representative, it's certainly not normal. I think it's been documented, though, in other fish species, but it is something that's been documented.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. We better move on.
Yep. So, again, this was, and we've touched on this a little bit, what was the sanctuary intended to accomplish? As I mentioned, the sanctuary was established first in 1996 in response to this very large and expanding recreational handle of sturgeon, and it was directed handle. It was clearly, you know, individuals who wanted to could go target on sturgeon in that time, oversized sturgeon at that time. So the sanctuary was adopted in time and place, basically where they spawn and when they spawn. Original sanctuary was relatively short term, about 2 months long, and only in the upper 5 miles of river. Between the years 2000 and 2010, as we continued our surveys for sturgeon mortalities post, during the fishery, we actually expanded the sanctuary both in time to its current state, which is May through August, as well as in area. So originally it was the upper, basically 4 miles. It had been moved down to, I want to say, about a 7 mile sanctuary, and then the last action was expanding the sanctuary to a full 9.5 miles. It's really adaptive management. We looked at what our intended result, you know, what we intended to accomplish, were we accomplishing that, and as a result of the answer that no, we were not accomplishing that, we took additional measures. So current regulations, I'll show this graphically in a minute, and I think everyone here has talked about it as well, but recreational fisheries, the entire 9.5 miles of sanctuary is still open to recreational fishing, but as was provided earlier, not for recreational fishing for sturgeon. It's open for shad, salmon and steelhead during salmon and steelhead seasons, certainly warm water species, pike, minnow, walleye, everything except sturgeon. Anglers, and it was, as was mentioned, cannot fish for or retain any sturgeon during the months in the sanctuary during the months of May through August. Commercial fishery, the upper 4 miles of the sanctuary is entirely closed to commercial fishing. That's a long-standing commercial fishing closure. Essentially, the area above Beacon Rock is closed, has been closed to commercial fishing, I want to say, since the early 1900s. Not since early 1900s, only since Bonneville Dam's been in place, so since 1938, to essentially protect salmon in areas where they're staging. They're below the dam, they're staging to pass the dam. So that sanctuary has been in place for long-standing. It's for all species, no commercial fishing permitted, and that has not changed. Commercial fisheries in the lower 5.5 miles of the sanctuary still occur as they did in the 90s. When the commission took the action to adopt a sanctuary, they were clearly focused on the recreational fishery where the handle had expanded, and the commercial fishery was not the focus of that discussion, nor the focus of any expansion. Therefore, they left the commercial fisheries in place. The commission did.
Before you go to the next slide, this is a good point, I think, for you to respond, if you would, on that last point. Can retain versus the language that we were talking about, targeted. Do you see a difference? How would you put a fine point on it?
Chair Gilliam, there's a lot of nuances in the language, but I will let me back up and talk a little bit about really sturgeon fisheries in general. There was a time up to and all through basically the 1980s, 1990s into, I want to say, the early 2000s, where we essentially had target sturgeon fisheries, commercial target sturgeon fisheries, where seasons were set with the specific intent to target sturgeon. In many cases, the sales of salmon were not allowed. The gear restrictions were put in place to essentially minimize the harvest of salmon, and the fisheries were put in place to simply target sturgeon. Those led to essentially very short fishing periods with relatively large landings. Over time, and as we're all sensitive to economics, and the commercial fishery is really focused on the economics of their activity, as people focused on economics, they said, wait a minute, it doesn't make any sense to flood the market with 2,000 or 4,000 sturgeon in a 12-hour period when we could just distribute those out, catch them during our salmon-directed fisheries, and add value to our salmon fisheries and actually raise the price per pound, the ex vessel revenue. So beginning in, and I didn't prepare this part of the talk, so I'm doing this from memory, but in the early 2000s, we implemented essentially weekly landing limits or weekly catch limits for the commercial fishery to spread the sturgeon catch out throughout the year. They, with the exception of the winter season, which was alluded to here earlier, which is a season that occurs during January, early February, we don't have any target sturgeon seasons anymore on the Columbia. All the sturgeon are caught basically during salmon-directed fisheries. So to answer your question, I can't remember what it was now.
No, you didn't, and I know that's very confusing.
I got it now. I remember. So the question was, is the difference between targeting versus versus incidental. So in the question, I think directly was, if an individual is commercial fishing in the sanctuary, the lower 5.5 miles of the sanctuary during a salmon season, can they target fish for sturgeon? And the answer is they certainly can, insofar as the gear, there are other gear requirements that may be in place. So if we have a mesh size restriction, they may not be able to effectively target sturgeon. But in terms of could they fish in an area where they were likely to catch sturgeon? They could. They absolutely could. And I think the point that some other folks were making earlier is that if they know they can only sell 2 or 4 or 5 sturgeon, there's not a lot of incentive to target on sturgeon if you're going to catch those in the course of your salmon fishing anyway.
That helps. We're not there, but that helps.
All right. Okay, so this is just graphic depiction. I meant to bring a laser pointer, but I forgot it. So you'll see on the right-hand piece of the graph, Bonneville Dam, that top little line up there is the Washington North Shore Powerhouse. You'll see the bottom end of the sanctuary is the upper end of Skamania Island here. Beacon Rock at the 5.5-mile mark is essentially the commercial fishing deadline. There's no commercial fishing permitted above Beacon Rock. The entire 9.5 miles, with the exception of a very small area immediately downstream from Bonneville Dam, is open to recreational fishing for whatever's open at the time, except for sturgeon. And likewise, commercial fishery. If there's a commercial fishery opener, the area downstream from Beacon Rock is open for the commercial fishery, and they are allowed to sell and retain and sell sturgeon. I think we've actually covered this a little bit, but the question that was posed by our commission and as well as public to our commission was why are the regulations different? Why do we allow the commercial fishery to target or retain sturgeon and not the recreational fishery? The sanctuary, as I mentioned, originally designed and established to reduce the piece of the equation that was perceived to be the problem, and that was this vastly expanding recreational fishery. Recreational anglers are prohibited from fishing for all sturgeon because the gear that they use to fish, whether it be legal size or oversized sturgeon, is essentially the same. You can target fish sturgeon, oversized sturgeon, with the same gear that you would target fish for legal size sturgeon. The folks that are really keyed in on targeting oversized sturgeon, you know, they take it to a whole other level in terms of the gear that they use. But nonetheless, gear restrictions were not viewed as an alternative to a sanctuary, with one exception. We did discuss at length the possibility that we could two alternatives that we could have done. We could have closed the area to all fishing, which we did not think was warranted because of the relatively low handle of oversized sturgeon in the other fisheries. We could have prohibited the use of bait. In this area, if you prohibit the use of bait, you essentially eliminate all sturgeon fishing because no one fishes sturgeon on a spin glow or a spinner or a flatfish or a quickfish. But it would have impacted a number of other fisheries that do use bait. And so we went down the path of sturgeon closure, close to sturgeon angling and retention.
How much more, Kurt? We've interrupted you, so we've been unfair to you. How much more do we have on the presentation?
You're getting close.
Okay.
Really close. Another key point is, and I'm going to show you a slide here earlier, is that the commercial fishing effort in this area is really low. It's not, you know, we're not talking about tens of thousands of vessel days per year in this area. We're not even talking about hundreds of vessel days. We're talking about 100 to 200 vessel days per year in this area, and a lot of that is shad directed, where they are using very light gear that you really can't catch an oversized sturgeon in it. And lastly, commercial fishing in the upper 4 miles is entirely closed, and that was to protect staging salmon in the area below Bonneville Dam. Quickly then, I kind of fast forward a little bit, 2011 recreational fisheries, period May 1 through August 31, it was open for the full 123 days for something. There were some closures for salmon, there was a closure in there in that period for steelhead, but it was open for shad, warm water, salmon, steelhead, walleye, pike minnow, during all or part of those 100, it was open for something during that entire 123 days. Retention of sturgeon was prohibited. Whether you were fishing for sturgeon or not, prohibited. We have a long-standing creel census program, 31,500 estimated angler trips in this area during the sanctuary period. You can see why we didn't want to take the approach of just close it entirely. The 31,000 angler days, that's a big deal. And it would not have been the best approach to just close the, you know, close the area from all for all activity would not have been a good balance. Commercial fishing during 2011, there was 41 open days during May 1st through August 31st. I think we heard Mr. Pauly refer to 11 days of salmon fishing. I believe that's correct. I think there was 30 days open for shad fishing during that period. Retention of retention of legal sized sturgeon was permitted. We had an estimated 123 deliveries from this area during those 41 fishing days. Not a lot of effort. We estimated in that commercial fishery that they handled 69 oversized sturgeon. Likewise, in the recreational fishery, which I missed that bullet earlier here a minute ago, we estimate that they handled 47 oversized sturgeon. So you see we've gone from the 5,000 or 3,600 to 5,000 number down to a couple hundred. And, you know, when we look at that, we think we've achieved what our intent was with the adoption of that sanctuary. As I mentioned, the commission has heard about this on a couple different occasions. Most recently in April, we briefed the commission on the issue. The commission additionally heard some public testimony and received a lot of public comment on this issue. They did direct us. They said they were comfortable, but they directed us to consider this and review the goals and objectives of the sanctuary as we embark on our 2013 process. We're basically updating our agreement with Washington, our sturgeon management agreement with Washington. The commission asked us to continue to keep an eye on the sanctuary and review it with an eye on the context. Are we accomplishing what we set out to accomplish? And we have three public meetings scheduled here in July. They're co-hosted meetings in the state of Washington, I believe Portland, Longview, and Astoria, to talk about sturgeon management and what we're going to do or change or how we're going to proceed in 2013. And I think that was my last slide. Questions?
We're probably out of time. Kurt, thank you for that. I'm not the only person with sport fishermen in their district. Mr. Buckmaster indicated he's one, and I understand that.
I will guarantee you I have more of those than commercial. We're not going to settle this today. We're focusing on the sanctuary question, but obviously as we talk, it's much bigger. We've had these contentious issues before on other bills. We've got a ballot measure that'll be decided this summer. I will say this, and I'm not going to have the final word if you have another comment, but I will ask you this. From my perspective, if you look at, from a sports fisherman point of view, can you see how it would appear to them, and there's two points of view here, we've heard them today, that this would be a double standard or an unfair situation with the sanctuary? If you're on one side and you can't, and the other side can you see how it would appear that way to sports fishermen?
Chair Gilliam, I mean, we certainly can see that. We see, you know, we hear from a broad array of constituents that have very many times disparate views on and perspectives on issues. We certainly can see that. I think when we look at the original intent of the sanctuary, though, and if it's fair to close the sanctuary entirely for commercial fishing, is it fair to close the sanctuary entirely then for recreational fishing? Because we do have a significant recreational fisheries that still occur there. If it's fair to prohibit the retention of sturgeon in all the recreational fisheries, is it fair to just simply prohibit the retention of sturgeon in the commercial fisheries that occur in the area? That was actually, our commission asked a number of questions on that subject, and there seemed to be they didn't sense that there was a lot of interest in just simply prohibiting the retention of sturgeon by the commercial fishery in the area. They sensed that it was close it for commercial fishing, and so in the case of is that equitable and allowing all the recreational fisheries to continue, I think again there's somebody else that's going to have an entirely different perspective on that.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of a broader issue here, concern for the species in general. If we have our breeding stock being interrupted because they are caught, is there any biologic imperative to halt the fishing of oversized sturgeon during May through August just to stop it?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, I think in large part we have done that already. With that, the sanctuary that's in place now has really eliminated, 95 to 99% of all handle of oversized sturgeon in that area. And so from our perspective, on the conservation side with regard to that 9.5 miles, which is the key primary spawning area, we're comfortable that we're not having a significant impact in that area.
But your words were in that area. I'm talking about the oversized sturgeon that are breeding elsewhere in the Columbia and having their breeding patterns interrupted.
Sure. Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, we actually have sanctuaries also in place in the Willamette and in the Columbia downstream from other spawning areas. So downstream from McNary Dam, where there's a key spawning area, we have a closure. I believe we have one now downstream from John Day Dam. We've basically taken this same step on all the sturgeon spawning populations that we have in the Columbia Basin as well as in the Willamette. And we've left the other fisheries open in those sanctuaries, so the other non-sturgeon-directed fisheries continue, but we have taken that step in the other areas. There are oversized sturgeon caught in other areas, but they're not spawning areas. And, oversized sturgeon swim around. They're going to go to, if they're not in the spawning area, though, our assumption is that the handling of them is not as critical.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Of course, I forgot you, Representative Boone. I apologize.
I was going to punch you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Taking a little different look at the socioeconomic of this issue, if you already have about half of that sanctuary closed off to this commercial fishery. And the commercial fishery, these are people's jobs. These are people's livelihoods. And I'm concerned about cutting off, although they might be very few compared to the recreational presence on the river, I'm concerned about literally cutting people off from their jobs and their ability to raise, make money for their family, to feed their families and pay their bills. And if, for example, what you were suggesting, the possibility, or Representative Witt, too, if, as my grade school principal said, what's fair for one is fair for all, never forgotten it. If you closed all the fisheries there and just closed them off to everybody, recreational and commercial, the recreational people would find somewhere else to fish, but they still have their job to go to. And I'm concerned about people's livelihoods, and I have a good many constituents who are commercial fishers on that river, and once things change, I'll probably gain a few more. And these are my constituents. These will be jobs lost. These will be homes lost, the whole continuum. So I just would like to caution people when you consider this, and we see this come up every session, comes around every session. I just can't imagine someone wanting to do away with someone's job. And that's what this is. That's what we're talking about here. Thank you for indulging me.
You're welcome. And Representative, I agree with you, and I appreciate your concern. It's a complex issue, as you know, and there are jobs on the other side. They're not in the river direct, like you're
right.
saying.
I know.
But there are lots of economic indicators and situations and jobs on both sides. And so I'm not negating your point, but I want to add that the other side has jobs at stake as well.
There's one other point I'd like to make.
Well, I'd like you to
just indulge me for 1 second more. And although I do have pictures to prove that I do fish, as I get older, I become sicker and sicker when I get on boats. So it's getting to be impossible. So I need to have fish to buy. And I like to eat fish at restaurants too, and I know a lot of people in Oregon do. And when the spring Chinook are running, my gosh, people will drop everything and spend a lot of money to buy them. So I'd like to be able to retain that ability to buy fish. And the commercial fishermen are the only people and women who can deliver these fish to the market. So
thank you, Representative.
And keep me from barfing.
Thank you for being here, Kurt. I'm going to adjourn the committee after I remind the committee that our next meeting is Friday, September the 14th. So it's not unlucky.
Okay.
I'll see you then. And the committee is adjourned.